having been there a few times as a delegate, the lot.
Hang on a second. Well, you've kept this completely buried forever.
Well, only ever as an underage delegate.
So, well, what does an underage delegate mean?
Someone that's not 60.
Yeah, exactly.
OTB AM. Live. Weekday mornings from 7:30 on the OTB Sports app.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
So if you haven't heard it already, Ronald Koeman got the boot last night from Barcelona after a fairly abject performance in La Liga. And it looks like Xavi is being lined up already for a replacement. That's how you do it, Man United. Or is it? Do you go back to a tribute manager who hasn't got a lot of experience in a minor league? Is it? Maybe Xavi's not the new Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Maybe Xavi is in fact the new Guardiola. We will see. I think that we're going to find this out pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's it's an interesting question. I'm not sure do you have a suspicion in your own head when you ask it, but like there are far more Ole Gunnar Solskjaers out there than Pep Guardiola's out there. Pep is the complete exception to the rule, I would suggest, and the Solskjaer thing happens way more often than it doesn't.
Yeah, it does, and it I mean, so I saw Miguel Delaney tweeting last night, European super club fires underperforming manager who scored late winner for club who were desperate to win for the first time in a long time in the 90s. And you know, it was kind of a Manchester United comparison, but maybe he wasn't Solskjaer, maybe Xavi is Solskjaer. What if they're about to walk into the thing they've just done?
Yeah, like there's every chance that that's the case, and you would suggest even that Barcelona are possibly even in a worse position than Manchester United were when Solskjaer took over. I think actually that's probably an understatement to say the least,
yeah.
Given Manchester United haven't yet become a selling club where they've, or are not a club to the best of our knowledge, who are €1.3 billion in debt.
Yeah, so the other thing is that we were talking about this before the show was... in the past we've speculated about when Xavi would take over, and I think one of the things that Graham Hunter said in the programme before was that after Messi goes, and then Messi went a little bit earlier than everybody had expected, so maybe this has just speeded things up, and who knows, maybe Xavi is like the second coming of Jesus Christ in football terms. Like, he may well be. Certainly what he did with his talent and him being the disciple of Guardiola on the field suggests that he has a very deep understanding of how the game should be played.
Well, of course, Al Sadd are top of the Qatari league, played seven, won seven. So, I mean, I'm sure I'm not bringing any new news to people this morning. Everybody's aware of that Al Sadd are 7-0 this season. They beat Salal 3-1 in their last game, which was on Tuesday night. I'm sure everybody was keeping an eye on that one. And they beat Al Arabi 4-0 at the weekend, or a couple of weekends before. They won one game 6-4 a couple of weekends ago, and then got through in the Emir Cup on 5-4 in penalties. So that is a form line that Xavi's coming in on. So he absolutely is Pep Guardiola, it turns out.
Yeah, and that would be the equivalent of winning the Norwegian league, would it? I mean, what's the standard of Qatari?
I don't know. How many World Cups have Norway hosted, Ger? How many Asian Cups have Norway won?
The Asian Cup certainly gives Qatar a little bit of an advantage on that. And will they have the floating clouds? Anyway, we digress. So that was the big story overnight. Ronald Koeman has been given the boot, and we'll get into that with Graham Hunter a little bit later on. But, I mean, it was, you were at the game at the weekend. Were the white hankies out? Were they all, like...
I just want to clear up again, just to reiterate for anybody who wasn't with us on Tuesday morning, that I was not kicking his car or spitting at his car afterwards. I wanted to distance myself from that. Like, he's been a dead man walking for quite some time now. The question had just been, did the hierarchy appreciate how bad his squad, how badly his squad has been gutted, I guess, over the last little while, to say, well, let's just let this guy see the season out because it doesn't really matter, or maybe at the end of this calendar year we maybe make a shift. Because like the task for the manager now is to get from what is it, ninth place into the Champions League places. 20 years they've been qualifying for the Champions League consecutively, so they're having a historically bad season. But it's pretty obvious why they're having a historically bad season, and it doesn't all end up at the door of Ronald Koeman. In fact, the vast majority of the problems aren't his fault whatsoever. You have to feel a little bit sorry for him, first off.
Yeah, everybody that he inherited has been rubbish, apart from the kids, and he's given the kids some game time. But like, Coutinho is back and they have to play him. Griezmann, would they have been better? Could they have kept Griezmann? I don't know. But that whole Griezmann situation where they bet the barn on it and the barn turned out to be on fire, it just hasn't worked. So
No, it absolutely like, I mean, when you go through the
Dembele, so, sorry, that's 300 million right there.
Yeah.
Dembele, Coutinho and Griezmann, and like Coutinho was playing last night. You're like, come on. Coutinho wouldn't get in the Spurs team at the moment, would he?
I would say that he would probably start his first couple of games and then get benched.
Coutinho would play for Watford at the moment, maybe.
He'd be good. Would he start ahead of Ismaïla Sarr or Dennis or Josh King? I'm not sure you guys into that front three at the moment. They're flying, obviously, after the weekend. But like you look at that A2, which looked like a pretty seismic moment, and like you would take that A2 team any day of the week ahead of this current Barcelona team. You had Suarez who left after that. You had Vidal who left after that. You had Rakitic who left after that. Those three players straight away improved this team. Obviously, Messi and Griezmann are the big ones then that left in the last summer window. So having to deal with a squad like that, missing those players is huge. Obviously, Pedri's got injured recently. He's been sweated as an asset, I think it's fair to say, over the course of the summer with the Olympic Games and with the Euros. Fati has gone through his injury problems. Gavi is still trying to find his feet there. It is a team that has been gutted as a result of injuries, as a result of overplaying, and as a result of clear financial malpractice at the club over the last 10 years or thereabouts. So he has been dealt a terrible hand. He paid his own compensation to get out of his Dutch gig because he wanted to land his dream job, which was a bad move. And Laporta wanted him gone in the summer, but just didn't have the heart to say, listen, he couldn't find a good enough successor, basically, was the thing. So we shouldn't feel sorry for somebody who's a very rich, successful person, but I feel sorry for Ronald Koeman this morning.
Well, he made a terrible decision to leave the Dutch, and it was really bad for the Dutch as well, because it looked like he had found the formula to get that Dutch team playing at a level that was the level they should be playing at. It was brilliant, beautiful football. All the young players looked like they were understanding of what the system was. And look, I mean, I don't know. I didn't watch every single second of them playing. When he left, things went to shit for Holland. And they've ended up back with Louis van Gaal. It's like, it's just been a disastrous situation for everybody involved. Whereas if he just stayed with Holland, I think they could have been much more competitive.
Well, he will get the Netherlands job again. That's for sure at some point down the line. But the one thing that did work out well for him is that he left the Netherlands. I'm not sure which came first. I think it was after Van Dijk got injured. So they were never going to win the Euros once Van Dijk got injured. And that really...
Would Van Dijk have come back if Koeman was still the manager? Remember, Van Dijk chose not to play in the Euros. It was like, he would have been fit.
Klopp versus Koeman, who are you picking? Well, I think we've seen early on the season that Van Dijk probably wasn't going to be ready for
fair
Euros,
enough.
So,
maybe.
But by and large, it's 90% bad luck, 10% good luck, if we're judging the fortune of Ronald Koeman over the last little while. And he probably isn't a fantastic manager either, that they can afford.
He's
to take,
not.
They can afford to take a chance on Xavi. Yeah, his track record isn't good whatsoever. So they can afford to take this chance on Xavi, I suspect. And Xavi obviously has a free hit at this season.
Well,
kind of.
Well, yeah. Or you do look for a manager with Champions League experience, and you do look for Ten Hag, and this is what a super club who knows what they're doing does, and you don't actually get Xavi in. So the Xavi thing is the obvious one, and everybody's talking about it, and it's hard to know what the truth is about the negotiations behind the scenes, but maybe they don't do that. Maybe they get the best available, most qualified manager.
Roberto Martinez.
Well, Ten Hag, right? Yeah. Roberto Martinez, I don't think is a...
Well, sources reported by ESPN overnight say that Roberto Martinez is very much in the frame for the job.
Well, you know, I mean, he's got a great agent.
He does. He does. And I mean, who did a better job with their country over the last little while, Koeman or Martinez?
I mean, Martinez has got one of the best collections of footballers that we've ever seen in international football. And
better collection of players than Koeman had, for sure.
They keep slightly underperforming.
And yeah, I don't think anybody would seriously think that Martinez is an automatic upgrade on Koeman whatsoever. It would be astonishing if they did go for him.
It looks to me like a like for like.
Yeah, 100%. Xavi does make sense in that context then, where first of all you get the fans off your back a little bit. You appoint a more recent club legend. You have I would say he is. He's a bigger giant than Koeman, if you think you're playing days. Like, I mean, there's no arguments about that. The risk is obviously just with his management style. And when I say a moment ago that he's got a free hit, kind of, the thing is that if you're sacking your manager now, the suggestion to me is that the Barcelona hierarchy are really, really worried about not qualifying for the Champions League. So all of a sudden, then the next manager does have a little bit of pressure on their shoulders, where it's like, you got to get into those places. And right now, that does not look like a guarantee whatsoever. The squad just isn't necessarily a Champions League squad. You've also got to remember that in this season's Champions League, they could crash out as well, and that would be a massive financial hit.
They will. They're more than likely to crash out, right?
Like, they got to go to Kiev next week, and that's after kind of limping by them 1-0 last week. There's no guarantee to get a result.
Yeah, now maybe there's a new manager bounce or a no manager bounce. We'll see. Okay, 7:40. We'll talk to Graham Hunter about that a little bit later on. I want to play you this. It's Caelan Doris talking about his concussion experience. Just have a listen.
It was pretty challenging period in a way. Obviously, with the Lions at the end of the season and the Six Nations being crucial in wanting to have a crack at that. So it was kind of a big decision in getting fully checked out. But yeah, I'm glad I did. And the medical staff were great and very accommodating in getting me checked out by some of the best people around. So I'm glad to have the full battery of tests and full baselines now. And I can always go back and compare in the future if there's worries again or if I get another knock. But yeah, glad to be back anyway. Obviously got a few games towards the end of the season. It was great being back in an Irish jersey for Japan and USA. Cracking on now to this season as well. Unfortunately, I had a little calf injury at the start of the season. But got two games under my belt there recently, so feeling pretty good. I think, initially it was sort of unknown how long I was going to be out for. And we're kind of in constant communication with a specialist over in Birmingham. And it was sort of play it by ear a little bit. I was doing a return to contact, a graduated return with Hugh Hogan, where we sort of started off maybe 40 or 50% hitting the bag and gradually built back up to try and increase my threshold around contact. So it was kind of gauging off how I was going with that. And in the end, we sort of stayed on the safe side and took a little bit longer time, which meant obviously missing La Rochelle and the rest of the Six Nations. But yeah, no, I'm glad I did. It was probably the prudent decision. I'm feeling good now.
That's Caelan Doris, who, by the way, is only 23. He turned 23 in April. So he's talking about a period when he was 22. And it must have been very scary for him in terms of what the future holds. And also then from a career perspective and from a life after rugby perspective. Because in the papers today, he's talking about cognitive issues, you know, forgetting people's names and that kind of stuff, the baseline testing that he's talking about there, his cognitive scores came down from what the baseline was and then came back up over a period of time too. So I've no doubt that to go through that at 22, particularly when you've been hyped the way Caelan Doris has, there's just been this expectation that he's going to be the Ireland number 8 for a decade, that he's that good, that he's potentially the best number 8 we've ever had. That's the level of how people have spoken about Caelan Doris in the background, and that's the expectation that he would have and his coaches would have, and then he's going to go on and have that great career. And then all of a sudden it was his European debut against Zebre, he gets concussed, and then his Ireland debut,
Treviso.
Two big debuts for him, two massive days, and it was at 4 or 5 minutes into the Scotland game. It looks like since then he hadn't quite been right until they took him out for 6 months. And, he was stood down. And so he's back. And we wish him all the best.
Yeah, it's kind of a tough thing to listen to. Obviously, he's pointed to the fact that he's been uber aware of this at the same time that obviously it sounds terrifying when you have those sort of moments of those short-term memory losses. But he does say at the same time that that has definitely been a thing. He's also been hyper aware of that. And he's been very, very cautious whenever he experiences something like that. And just the ability to plug yourself out of that, not feel the pressure to say, it's a Lions year, I have to put on the jersey every single week here. I guess that's definitely the good thing you can take out of this a little bit, but it's pretty harrowing even looking at some of the quotes in the papers as well this morning, because it's in all the newspapers about what he's experienced at such a young age. Like, he was going to be a 23-year-old Lion. I think that was a done deal. So to take himself out of that situation and to get his baseline results is obviously going to stand him in good stead in the long term. But maybe there's also a wider question about the sport as well and kind of what you're open to, given it's happened so frequently to a player like him.
I think that wider question is definitely something the sport is grappling with. And, you know, he speaks at length about how grateful he is for the quality of care that he got, and that is definitely a change. You know, that's definitely the sport has improved and it recognises that it needs to improve, but I still feel like it's got a distance to go. It still feels like all sports have a distance to go. There was stuff coming out last week about inter-county GAA players not getting the required attention that, that they should get when there was concussion. There was a bit of a debate and a bit of back and forth about that, but we probably, like, we've been talking about this for a long time, but we probably don't talk about it enough.
Mm. And also you have that story this week with the Rugby League players as well, filing action as a result of concussion. And then there's a separate story this morning on the back of the Times about hookers actually voicing their concerns about the new scrum laws and how it's not protecting them whatsoever, and the huge fears of paralysis that, that exists within that position. So it's just story after story after story, considering the growth of the players physically and the attrition levels going nowhere, and the rugby calendar not exactly slowing down either, which just creates this cocktail of worry, I suspect, if you're a young rugby player at the moment.
Yeah, no doubt. 7:45 this morning. Here's what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock on the show. We're going to speak with Áine O'Gorman about the win against Finland. We've got Paul Bellew from the Galway Hurling Board on to talk to us about how they got their man in Henry Shefflin. James Ryan, we're going to play you 10 minutes with Will O'Callaghan from their conversation. And also then John Duggan talked to us about ticket scalping. Are you all willing to pay over the odds for tickets for sports matches? And what about that £125 ticket price for the All Blacks? We're doing some November work, as you can see. Graham Hunter, 9:05.
A head start.
Talking about Ronald Koeman. I think, you know, I want to win this on. I'm in it to win it. Colin in Black and White is the new Colin Kaepernick. What is it, docudrama? Is that what the correct term probably is? We'll bring you some interviews with the stars of that at 9:20, and then we get the thoughts of Fiona Coughlin and Keith Wood at 9:30, or sorry, Jerry Thorney at 9:30. If you want to get in touch with us this morning, 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number, or of course you can always just leave a comment on the YouTube stream. But we're turning our attention back to a brilliant win for the Republic of Ireland women's team against Finland on Tuesday night. And I'm delighted to say Áine O'Gorman is with us. Áine, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. How are you? All good. And yourself?
Yeah. So what was the atmosphere like in the dressing room immediately after an away win like that? Because these wins, they don't happen very often in anybody's careers, but that's a big, big win. So what was the atmosphere actually like?
Yeah, look, it's probably the biggest win I've been part of today. Yeah, look, obviously there's a good buzz around the place, a good confidence and a good belief as well. But I think it's important as well that we keep our feet planted, grounded, that because there's still a long way to go in this campaign. But obviously it helps when you get off to such a good start.
Yeah, it's a balancing act, really, isn't it? Because you want to bottle that moment and make that the thing that inspires everybody, but you don't want everybody to get too carried away to think that it's going to be easy. So it's like, let's feed off this and let's remember exactly how we feel, because it's a very special moment. So I guess your experience helps when it comes to having those conversations with people.
Yeah, I think so. Look, I think it's important to enjoy the moment as well and enjoy a victory, especially in the nature we won the game in the end. It was kind of back to the wall stuff for the last 10-15 minutes, and we all stuck together, showed great camaraderie, and got the game over the line. And mind you, that last 4 minutes of added time is the longest 4 minutes of my life. I was never so relieved when the referee blew the whistle. But yeah, look, it's important to enjoy the moment and take the good things out of the game and see where we can still improve, and look forward to the game next month against Slovakia and Georgia. I think Slovakia can't be underestimated at all. They're really, really good fourth seed. So that game's really, really vital for us too.
Can you talk us through the second goal, Áine? Because obviously it comes from your interception.
Yeah, look, I think I've just been taking up them positions when we were attacking them. The left all game was coming in a little bit, and yeah, just managed to win the ball and play it out to Jamie Finn. And obviously it was a really, really good turn by her. Played it down to Heather Payne. He was on fire all game, drove inside. Maybe the keeper could have done better, but the hunger and desire for it by Denise O'Sullivan to get to the back post. And it was a great goal. And look, it was a great reaction, I think, to them getting back in the game. And then it was 1-1, and we kept driving on. I think there was only 2 minutes in the difference, and we went up to the pitch and got the goal back. And to me, that's the difference in this team as well, that belief and that confidence that we'll stick to our game plan and we'll keep going till the end.
When Finland had a lot of the possession in the second half, Ireland were still creating chances, not least the goal, Denise O'Sullivan's goal in the second half. How much of that was a consistent plan and something you talked about in training and the build-up to the game, sort of sitting in but not parking the bus, sitting in and waiting for the opportunity to catch them on the break?
Yeah, for me, I think it's just obviously we obviously want to remain compact and organised throughout the game and then push forward and press when we can and press when it's on. But if you have to drop off for moments in the games when maybe teams are dominant. And I think that's something we're good at, something we've taken probably from the Australia game, the Australia friendly, and the Sweden game, where I think we were unfortunate in the end, maybe not to get a point out of that game. And we managed to bring into the Finland game as well. So it's good. It's obviously good that we're able to be flexible in our team organisation.
You've 110 caps. You've seen everything, right? I'm very interested in the evolution of this team, because it looked like it would have been easy for the group to become, self-conscious and lacking in confidence after the run of defeats in the friendlies. But then there was obviously something building throughout that. Just you weren't getting the results to go together. The big win against Australia is obviously hugely important. And then it would have been very easy to feel a little bit depressed again after an own goal costing you against one of the best teams in the world. But that didn't happen. You took confidence from the defeat, which is a sign that the group believes in what they're doing. Is that a fair summation of how it's going?
Yeah, I think so. I think we obviously played a lot of friendly games against higher ranked nations, and that was in preparation for moments like you've seen in the Finland game, playing against Sweden. Australia for me, that camp was kind of the turning point where that belief and that confidence came into our play as well, and all the hard work in the previous building up to the previous friendlies finally started to play off. And there's a lot of learnings from when you play higher ranked opposition as well, and you have to learn from all their moments, all the times, and the highs and the lows, and probably even learning from previous campaigns. And I think we're all determined that this is our moment to qualify for campaign. But like I say, we keep having to take it one game at a time. There's still a long way to go.
What about the Australia camp gave you that belief? Obviously, the result was there, but what was happening behind the scenes there that gave you that belief that you mentioned?
Yeah, I think everyone's just been training well and regrouped after obviously a little bit of a break and just happy to get back in. Obviously the equal pay announcement, Sky Sports coming on board, and just all the backing we're getting as well. And you can even see the backing we're getting even on social media and the positivity around the team. So that's obviously great to see. And I think we're feeding off that as well. And that's kind of like a welcome pressure. And we keep having to build on that and as grow as a team going forward.
It will be an interesting contrast if this team does get to a playoff between, as you mentioned there, the amount of backing this team is getting in this campaign compared to, say, the time you guys played in Iceland.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose it's like night and day, but that's why the game's grown, I think, globally as well, across the world, that women's football is probably one of the fastest growing sports. So obviously it's great to see that we're backed here in Ireland and people are getting behind us, and Talla was sold out the last for the Sweden game, and we hope we see the same with back to full capacity in November, and that everyone gets out and supports us and really rallies us on, and we keep continuing to get the results we need to reach that World Cup playoff. But they're still, like I keep going back to, there's still a long, long way to go.
In terms of the evolution of the style of play as well, you talked about knowing when to press and when not to. I definitely feel like Irish teams, we do like to put the opposition under pressure. It's, you know, it's part of our DNA since the 80s, and we like to be scrappy and we like to be causing trouble for the opposition. It gives us a sense of being, look, generally we will end up with our backs to the wall at some point in the game, but it does also give us a sense at least that we're taking the fight to the opposition. How has that pressing game evolved? Because it was very evident early on in the Finland game in particular that was definitely what you were trying to do.
Yeah, look, I think it's just having belief in our team organisation and our team setup that we're all working cohesively together, that if one presses that we all follow through, and that we're obviously organised, whether we're dropping off or we're stepping on the front foot as well. So it's obviously something that we work on. There's good team communication, a good cohesion, maybe a little bit more consistency in the squad, and the team helps that as well and transpire on the pitch. So look, we have to pick our moments. We've got a hugely talented squad. Like you look at the likes of Katie McCabe, Denise O'Sullivan, Heather Payne, who I mentioned was off the charts the other day, and a lot of experience as well with Niamh Fahey and Louise Quinn. So there's a really good recipe there for success. So we have to keep it going.
How long does that game actually take to get right, Anya? Like, how many training sessions did it take before you started to realise, okay, this pressing game is going somewhere and we're really working as a unit?
Yeah, look, I think it's, like I said, something just started to click. I think in the Australia game, we've learned from maybe our previous defeats to Iceland, Denmark, and Belgium, and obviously we're prepared in our game plan, and we went out and executed as well. But yeah, look, it is work in progress, and just having that belief, obviously, and with the players around us that we can go on. And I think it's something we're always really good at, is just working hard and getting stuck in and playing with that passion and pride. Like you said, it's in our DNA that we're there. We'll always fight till the end.
Yeah, and the two last things I wanted to ask you about. Eileen Gleeson obviously is heading over to Glasgow, and like, that's great that there are coaches coming through the Irish system who are getting jobs like that. And you know, obviously everybody wishes her the very best. At the same time, it's clear she's going to be a bit of a loss from the Ireland setup.
Yeah, I think so. I think Eileen will be a big loss, and obviously she's got a lot of knowledge and experience and a great passion for the game in Ireland. She's been involved in the Women's National League and women's football in Ireland for a long time, and is obviously Irish through and through. So I suppose obviously just want to take the moment to wish Eileen the best of luck, and she will be missed, but hopefully we'll catch up with her again soon.
It is a good sign that people are coming looking at this setup and going, yeah, we're going to take some of the coaches from here, and that you can come through the Irish system and then end up working at a club like Glasgow. You know, again, it's not great that we have to export everything all the time, but at the same time, if we do, then it's great that people are getting recognised for that.
Yeah, definitely. I think Eileen's obviously worked really hard for years as a pro licensed coach, abundance of knowledge, very dedicated to football and her role as a coach and a manager. Any time I've worked under her, so it's definitely more than she deserves, and I suppose it's something for coaches coming through the system to aspire to too.
You mentioned some of the class players we have at the moment. How do we make sure that the players who are full-time and getting the opportunity to rest and recover, and the players who aren't full-time, that the gap doesn't get too big, that we continue to make sure that the home-based players are as progressive as they need to be to continue the drive to qualify for the World Cup?
Yeah, look, obviously we've got home-based training sessions, which we'd like to see happen more regularly, but if not that, a lot of hard work and dedication goes in. The girls are going training with boys' teams to get extra sessions in. Obviously, club football's doing in full flow as well for the next few weeks too. So I think, it's just doing what you have to do to get up to that level and be ready when you go into camp that you're at that level. And look at like Savannah McCarthy in the squad. And I love seeing Women's National League players in the team. And I think it just shows all the hard work and dedication. And it's nights like that in Finland that it all pays off for me. So, look, I'd love to see the Women's National League go semi-professional in time. So hopefully that will happen soon.
And how often are you guys having the home-based training sessions? So that essentially that's the national squad coming together and training, is it?
Yeah, so we have any players that are based in Ireland and will come together. So we at least come together at least once before every camp we go in. So that just gives us that extra session just to make that step up so we're ready when we meet up with the rest of the squad.
And in an ideal world, would that happen once every fortnight, once a week, once a month? If money was no object and time was available to everybody, what would be perfect on you?
If money was no object, we'd love to all be full-time here in Ireland. But yeah, like once a week, once every 2 weeks would be ideal. But at the moment, it's once a month. Look, and it's obviously working to a certain degree because we're still going out there and getting the results, but that's what I'd like to see in the future alongside the teams going semi-professional.
And is training with the lads working for you, Anya?
Yeah, I think so. I really enjoy it. Obviously, it's obviously a good pace and good tempo teams set training sessions. So yeah, I go training with the under 17 boys in Bray Wanderers as well. So yeah, totally enjoy that. It's obviously helping my game progress.
You know, as I said, you've seen the whole roller coaster of emotions about what it's like to be involved with the Ireland football team and seen how the sport has grown. At the moment, what's your sense about your own involvement into the future as well? And I'm obviously not retiring you at all here, but like, I guess at various stages in the past, most of your teammates and contemporaries would have had I'm done with this, I'm walking away, I've had enough. But it feels like now, your generation in particular are going to be the next generation who kicks this sport on into the future. Is that something that you see, that you feel is part of your own future?
Yeah, look, I suppose the game here is growing all the time. There's obviously, I'm doing my coaching badges at the moment as well, and hopefully when the time comes and I retire again, And Owen, I don't think, knows about the highs and lows any more than myself. So, look, hopefully that players, when they evolve, they stay involved in the game in some capacity. But while you're still playing, you have to enjoy it and keep creating that legacy.
On a week like this, you must be pretty happy with your decision to come out of retirement.
Yeah, it all pays off. Like, I think it's nights like that in Helsinki that make it all worthwhile. And obviously, we really enjoyed the moment and just grinding out that result. So look, really excited for the future. And let's go into next month with lots of positivity.
Yeah, and hopefully full house for it as well. Anya, great stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. Cheers.
No worries. Thanks, lads. Chat to you soon.
That's Anya Gorman there giving us her thoughts on a 2-1 win against Finland during the week. That is definitely one of those great Irish sporting careers, which has completely seen every aspect of it. A couple of quick comments for you. Shane says, Koeman gone, no surprise. Steve Bruce to Barca, says Kieran. Is there going to be a job that Steve Bruce doesn't get linked with now? as like poor ironic meme.
No, there isn't. He's got everything in the meme locker at this point. Like, I mean, the question is, who's playing centre back for your club? Because that is the joke. That's the punchline in all of these.
Ian says, this is not fact checked. Ian says, Koeman was the first Barcelona coach to lose 3 straight Clásicos since Irishman Patrick O'Connell.
Yeah, I did see that stat during the rounds actually the other day. Patrick O'Connell got a statue, obviously, didn't he?
Not for the football.
Not for the football, yeah.
The war was on and...
That's a good point.
He had involvement in taking the team away, takes the team to America, and they raise money and they send the money back and... He's got a very interesting story, Patrick O'Connell, because obviously he played for Man United and was the captain of Man United when Man United fixed the game. It was a Good Friday 1913 against Liverpool. They lose 2-0 and he leaves in disgrace. They get caught match fixing, which, you know, it's like a say it ain't so, Joe, level of... it should be a big story, but we've managed to, like... I know, he saved Barcelona. Sure, it's all... It, like all good Irish... heroes, he's a bit of a rogue.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a bit of a character.
Like a bit of match fixing, sure.
So that's all Ronald Koeman had to do to get a statue.
Match fixing. Yeah. OTBM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We're going to take a quick break. We're back talking what's in the newspapers today. And also, we're going to turn our attention back to Galway Hurling and Paul Bellew, the Galway Hurling committee chairperson, responsible for one of the biggest off-season stories that we've seen in a long, long time. Henry Shefflin is going to be the new Galway manager. We're going to find out how they did it next.
OTB AM.
All right, 3 minutes past 8 here this morning. If you want to get in touch, we'd love to hear from you. 087-9180-180 is the WhatsApp number. Or, of course, you can always leave a comment on the YouTube stream. I'm delighted to say Paul Bellew is with us. He's the Galway Hurling Committee chairperson. And, Paul, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, Ger. Owen, how are you doing?
Yeah, very good. It's been, you guys have been responsible for one of the biggest bombs going off in the hurling championship in an off-season that we can remember, where out of nowhere, Henry Shefflin was announced as your new inter-county manager. How did you manage to keep it secret?
Yeah, you say out of nowhere. I've heard things flying around like 11th hour, and I wish it was. I wish it was that quick for us, because it certainly felt a lot longer. There was a media storm around this Galway appointment going back for 6 weeks, let's be very honest about it. A few of us had a certain job to do, and we made a commitment from the start that we would do what we had to do, keep our powder dry. There was times we had wanted to come out given the amount of nonsense that was floating around, but we had to concentrate on what we do. And I suppose just one thing to be very clear, we kept our position on every candidate the exact same. There was a lot of attention on certain candidates. That didn't come from us, to be fair. It didn't maybe come from them either, but we treated everyone the same. And, we engaged them and we met them, sat down with them. Everybody went through the same process. And as I said, it came from other sources rather than ourselves. So, you know, it's nothing more exciting or glamorous than that, Ger, I'm afraid.
We might get into the bits and pieces of that as well, because obviously in the middle of all this we were having fairly lengthy conversations about Galway hurling, and I make no bones about being fascinated since the 1980s and going to watch All-Ireland semi-finals when Cyril Farrell was in charge with that great team. I think Galway have been one of the most interesting stories and the biggest stories in Irish sport, given the quality of success that you've had at underage in particular. So when you're talking about the stuff that was floating around, we were certainly contributing to some of that. And I know that from your perspective, you'd like to get the story out about how progressive your board are and what you're actually trying to achieve. So maybe you might tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, and look, that's it. And look, you're not going to get the this county board official coming on ranting and raving. And look, I was long enough on the other side ranting and raving at Galway County Board. But I suppose my defence is I always did it on the convention floor or at delegate meetings, and people had the right to reply. And, you know, I certainly had my say. And then I decided to do something about it and get involved. And I think it's my 20th month involved in two COVID years, and it feels like 20 years. But look, there was a piece, let's be straight up about it. I'm going to be very direct and forthright about it. It was James's piece. And look, at I have the world of time for James. We've had some good chats in the last few days. So this isn't coming on a tit for tat. But I think he was upset and passionate about maybe where things were going. And it just felt like things were in a bit of a time warp from a few years ago about some of the accusations that were been put around. And I'm coming on today just to set the record straight. Galway GA, as you said, has been dramatic. It's time to get boring now. We just want to point out what is going on and has been going on for the last few months and even over the last year. And, you know, it has become this bit of a punch bag, Galway GA in general, not just Galway hurling, and well, financial issues, et cetera, et cetera. And we haven't done well in getting the message out about what's moved on from 2 years ago. And maybe today is maybe a bit of a chance to do that. And okay, look, there'll be people out there typing into thing going again, gangsters, et cetera, whatever, the whole lot. That narrative has to change. And it changes now.
So you were involved in making sure that this is a more boring conversation in future, where the administration of the sport isn't being spoken about as much as what's happening on the field of play. So you were involved, for example, in bringing Mazars in and getting the corporate governance back to where it needs to be.
Yeah, there was four of us, I suppose, really, that had a lot of work to get that out, and very proud of what was achieved on that. And we're moving on from that. And as I said, two of those people are now, one is the county treasurer, one is I'm Hurley Committee Chairman, not county board per se, but we're involved. These were the people that we were looking for to step up, etc. And I think when we just heard some of the stuff the last few weeks, it's as if nothing has changed. But, you know, on the GAA, it's very frustrating for us as well. It takes time to change. But just on the hurling front, I suppose your question is, why have we won loads of minors and not won anything else? I think that's what we all ask. And we probably were a little bit behind the curve. But I suppose just as a few things that I would like to point out, like Henry's appointment is brilliant, but it's only one facet of what we're doing. And I think we released a statement last week, and I think it was picked up locally anyway. Maybe the last paragraph was one of the more exciting lines, you know, that it combines our ambition to create a sustainable player pathway and for development. So just a couple of the things that are happening out there for listeners and for Galway people in particular. You know, we've put Lucas, you know, Lucas is very highly regarded. Lucas is no longer, you know, the Galway senior hurlers SNC guy. Lucas is now the head of athletic development for Galway GA senior under 20 minor and our new adult development squad for the next 3 years. So Lucas's remit will be to design, implement hurling specific SNC for all squads and oversee the other members of the SNC team. And just to give you an example, Ger, we hired another SNC person 3 weeks ago to focus on our development squad and to support our underage. And along with that, for 2022, we'll have two other people specifically assigned to our minor and our under 20. So that'll be four pretty much full time for next year SNC people. And then we'll have a 5-team intern to focus on that as well, where we bring in people in college, they support the guys there, they upskill, they learn, and we actually bring them back into our system then. That's the idea that it'll reproduce. So long story short, Galway Hurling will have 9 people working on their SNC for 2022. From 17 years of age up to adult, to incorporate over 100 players.
I think, in fairness, that was one of the points that James was making. He was concerned that Lucas might be lost to the system given the domain knowledge that he's built up. So that's great to hear that has been sorted out.
And it has been underway for a while, and that's been in the works. And in fairness, I will say this, I'm not going to come out and advertise something that's being done until it's done. I'm probably out a bit earlier, but it had been done. The aims have been shared with the clubs. Maybe that's not getting through, and I understand that, but as I said, we weren't going to come out crowing about something before it started. More so, we want to complete it. The fruits of this will be, I think, post-Henry Shefflin, to be honest with you. And I suppose the biggest other piece, what we've done is we've created now a formalised adult development squad. And that's focused on player pathway from under 20 onwards in particular, because we have been losing these guys. And we're going to have a point when we have all managers in place, we're going to sit down and we're going to appoint the head of this adult development squad who will manage it in conjunction with the senior under 2017. All on the one page, all working together. No more managers going on solo runs, not speaking together, not getting together, not integrating into one vision. They'll all be combined in a charter, and the charter is development, development, development. And the aim of this, lads, is to keep guys that maybe just don't make it straight away. You know, the late developers that maybe just physically aren't there, hurling-wise aren't there. So they will have three facets to what they're doing. They'll be kept in the underage system. They'll be exposed to Lucas's and team of S&C. To nutrition, basically best practice on that, and to best practice hurling. So they will have coaches on the development side. They'll be brought in and out of the seniors in the 20s if they're not quite there. They stay in the system and they get every chance that in a couple of years, if this guy has made the step up, he follows his program, we'll be giving them matches against the other teams. In he comes, he's ready, he's physically ready, he's mentally ready, which is very important, and he can come in and his hurling is up to speed. So that adult development appointment is probably, maybe it's the biggest one we'll do in the next 3 months. It won't get as much attention, but that's where we are, and that's what's been going on in Galway.
That's a plan, and it sounds like, you know, I'm always on the show talking about, we always talk about the best in class, and so the Doves football, and now it's Limerick hurling, and before that it was Kilkenny hurling, but no one's ever become successful by aping what somebody else is doing. You have to do your own thing, and it sounds like you've got a plan there to keep the players from disappearing and from not being aware of what the responsibilities will be when they eventually make it to the senior squad. And that kind of brings me nicely. Is that a way in some ways of stepping outside the club structure and trying to bring some unity there? Because one of the other points that James made, and I think it probably holds for most counties who aren't winning All-Ireland, is that if the clubs run off the championship, they're happy, and that's their interest. And we've seen factional self-interest is at the heart of a lot of the organisation, where if so long as my parish or my club within the parish is doing well, then actually I'm all right, Jack. And if you're involved at county level, you need to think separately from those clubs. So how do you get the clubs who have very, very intense rivalries in Galway to think a little bit laterally and to think about the county for at least a portion of their thinking time?
Yeah, well, we have to do much better with them as well. And I think what they need, and this will be part of Lucas's role, is we need to upskill the clubs in terms of, again, from an S&C nutrition point of view. That's the key area as well, because there's plenty of hurling coaches. That's very good. But it's to show them this vision that we do have for Galway, that we realise potential among those players. And I think the key point is what you touch on. If these players that come in and we widen the net, sure, they go back, if they don't make it for Galway, they go back to their clubs, you know, of a much higher standard in terms of personally, hurling-wise, expertise-wise. And that's what brings your clubs with you. And just on the club championship piece, you know, it's not what it used to be in terms of, it's still the most popular club championship in the country, the biggest club championship. You'll see that from our gates, our streaming figures last year. The rivalry isn't as bitter and intense as it would have. That's probably another myth that needs to kind of go as well, along with a couple of other things, you know. And just while I am on it, because one thing, we have had financial issues, we've had governance issues, that sometimes gets tied in with resource. And I think it's as good a time anyway to set the record straight, and I won't be too popular for doing this, and I wasn't too popular probably in my own county board when I did it, but you know, this people will laugh at this, and I'm waiting for the reaction later on today. Galway hurlers are probably in the top two resource squads in the country. Now, it's not too often that's said, and most people don't believe it, but I spent a lot of time the last few weeks talking to managers, ex-managers, other county board officials in other counties. I've had some of the worst 3 weeks of my life, but two of the best three as well. The hurling public would talk to me. We are somewhere in the region of 20% over most teams in what we make available and supply to get our team to an All-Ireland final. We consistently have backroom teams in excess of 20 people. Our budget to get to an All-Ireland is over 700k if needed to be. And that's a budget. It's a target. It's not meant to be spent if it doesn't have to be, but it's there. Our players are exceptionally well looked after, which they will all testify to. The relationship between, I can speak from the hurling committee side, and the players is as good a relationship as I've ever been involved in from a work point of view or a amateur point of view. And, you know, again, people might be shocked at hearing some of that, but that is the facts. And as I said, just because there's debt issues and COVID, you would have a cash flow issues and huge challenges, we remain one of the best resource squads in the country.
Taking that into account then, Paul, is there necessarily a target that gets set out for the managers to say you have to be winning All Irelands?
No, that target will not come up in my vocabulary. Our simple ambition is, over the next few years, in every facet, is that we maximise our potential in every area, and that the only reason we get beaten is because A, we're not good enough, would be a bounce of a ball. The idea over the next few years was we want to be hitting All-Ireland semi-finals, probably 4 in every 5. If we're good enough, we'll win them. But I'll promise you this, you won't be able to blame County Board. You won't be able to blame lack of money. You won't be able to blame, you won't blame the players. You won't be able to blame preparation. We will have everything in place that makes us reach our potential. If we're good enough, we're good enough. I think the best way to, and I chatted to Eddie O'Sullivan about this, Eddie was on our panel, is you're looking at maybe a Green Bay model or something like that, that you're getting to the business end every year because everything is in place. And if you can get over the line, you get over the line. But no excuses now anymore. No nonsense. No sideshows. Galway loves drama. It loves politics, but needs to stop now. All on the one page. All going forward together. I said, myself and James had this conversation last night. And as I said, Galway hopefully is about to get very boring. And I hope they don't, but I certainly hope they do.
This is probably not the question to ask then, if you're looking to keep it boring, but is Galway's Aaron Rodgers, aka Joe Canning, going to make a return?
See, this absolutely nothing to do with me. That's a decision for the manager. The manager manages, and we support and facilitate him behind the scenes, and we stay out of that stuff. We don't pick that. Would we all love to see it? Of course we would. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen.
And Paul, to go back to getting Henry Shefflin involved, right? So we've obviously seen Henry's career as a manager come about and be very successful very early on. But I suspect that if he thought there was going to be any bullshit in the background, then he also would have said, you know, thanks but no thanks. So I guess you coming out and telling us about what is in the background and the long-term plans you have with strength and conditioning, in a way, it sounds like you kind of had to put those in place to be able to get somebody of Henry Shefflin's stature interested in the first place.
Yeah, and we have to do it anyway. Not even Henry Shefflin's stature. If anyone took the job in Galway, these are the things that had to be done. But you're right in what you say, in that, you know, again, let's come back to some of the narrative out there. Not only Henry Shefflin, the other three candidates, and we forget about the two brilliant Galway candidates we had in this mix as well. You know, we sat down on the Sunday after we finished a certain round of interviews, and we all looked at each other and we said, we're in a good place here. Whoever we appoint as Galway manager, even before our final interview, we're happy now. But, you know, the likes of Henry or whoever else, they don't get involved with a group of chancers. You know, they saw what was being done. They saw how it was done. They saw it was in the background. And again, about the 11th hour appointment, the amount of conversations that go on before people actually proceed to formal interview, there's 4 to 5 hours in that prep. You know, these guys don't make these decisions lightly anymore. It's a huge commitment. Not even if you're coming from Kilkenny, if you're coming from Athenry, it's a huge commitment. So all those things have to be in place, and they have to be happy with those things, and that's the standards, you know, you need to reach.
And what was the story with Micheál Donoghue? Because it looked like he was interested at one stage, then he was out, and then he was back in.
Yeah, but again, that's narrative on the media side. I can only tell you how it went down for us. And I've told the delegates this when we reconvened 2 weeks ago. You know, everybody assumed that Micheál was the front runner, the favourite. I suppose he was the chosen candidate among us all, to be straight up about it, when the vacancy arose. Again, I took this position 20 months ago. I had no previous involvement. I never overlapped with Micheál's time. So I sat down with him. I had a fresh approach to it. I to be straight up to him as well, in fairness to Micheál, and there's been an awful lot of noise out there, and it hasn't been fair to Micheál, it hasn't been fair to Galway County Board, and it spun the things outside of this, and then, you know, it almost became a one versus the other when nothing could be further from the truth. And again, that won't suit the narrative, but I actually rang Micheál and asked him to go forward. There was meant to be nominations to the club or whatever. I rang him and said, we want you to be the next Galway hurling manager, and he goes, look, let's just sit down, and he gave me that courtesy. And you know, we all know the dangers of assuming, lads, and I suppose we sat down for nearly 2 hours. We had a brilliant conversation, and it probably became apparent to me as well that I was shouldn't have assumed, and that he wasn't maybe in the position to come back that we had thought he was, for personal reasons. Timing wasn't right. What he said to me in terms of what he did for me, in terms of he saw where things were going with development wise, he had seen the document that was put out, he's fully supportive of it, and he's asked in any way he can help that he will get behind. And that's, you know, again, that's not the fun story. I presume people would much rather if we were at loggerheads and what have you. Then we had spin-off that he made demands, that negotiations broke down. Negotiations didn't even start. I did ask him to take the weekend to consider it, and I know he did, and I know he deeply did. And he came back to me on the following weekend, and I said, are you definitely done? Is there any one thing I can do? He said, there's nothing you can do. It's not now. And then we had all the rumour, conjecture, and the damage it did. And again, not caused by Micheál and not caused by Hurling Committee or County Board. And it just did so much damage. And I think the James interview was a byproduct of that. You know, everyone should do whatever we can. We did whatever we can, but it didn't even get to the point of discussing budget. You know, that's the bones of it, lads. And that's all. I can only give you my version of what happened, and that's what it was for me.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. And then you mentioned the candidates from Galway. Were they the existing underage managers? Is that
they were? I mean, that's what I said. I would not betray any confidence, but it's been well out there now. I would not have commented on Davey ever until he, you know, came out himself on the Late Late Show and said it. But the boys were brilliant. You know, they really put their best foot forward for the role. They have a huge role to play in Galway hurling going forward in numerous capacities. But yeah, they were the other two. But the standard was exceptionally high.
Right. And what was it in the end that made you want to go for Henry?
Yeah, this is like, it's been bigger than, like, I thought it'd be big, but it's been bigger than we ever thought. But we were concentrated on Henry the manager, not Henry the player. And I know people might find that hard to believe. And look, obviously his player reputation does, but, you know... He was on our radar 2 years ago. I was involved in the selection committee the last time as a delegate, and he was on our radar. And basically, once the Micheál piece wasn't going to go ahead, you know, I just took out the blank sheet and wrote a couple of names down. And easy to say now, and would I tell you the same if it was someone else? I probably would, but I'll tell you the truth. We got the number one candidate that we wanted, and he was put down at number one. And when we interviewed him, just I knew from the conversations with him, you know, a serious high degree of intelligence, the questions he asks, just his view, like there's a simplicity to what he's going to bring, I think. You know, it's going to be hurling. I know that sounds a bit basic, but, you know, he's smart, he's modern, but there's just this Kilkenny ruthlessness, I think, that sits behind it that impressed us, you know. His experience with Ballyhale, Eddie O'Sullivan focused an awful lot on culture, dressing room dynamics. You know, maybe our dressing room as well needs that bit of a shake up. And, you know, he's dealt with some stuff like that as well. And how he'd approached that just blew us away, really.
I think that's an underrepresented or misunderstood part of the Ballyhale thing. Is like everybody assumes, oh, those lads won all Ireland together. But it's a club. We all know that clubs have rivalries within them and all that kind of one family, somebody sits in the wrong place, something happens, and he walked in and solved that relatively quickly, and they reached their potential. So if he can do something similar with the dressing room in Galway, then we're in for a very exciting period. It sounds a little bit like it was a kind of a dating thing where you're both feeling each other out, because you both kind of need to make sure that actually you both want it. Like, you needed to prove to him, but he kind of needed to prove to you too, because, you know, it's not like there was a track record of inter-county management there too. So it's a leap of faith collectively.
Yeah, well, look, we have a very... It is. And it was very, you know, as I said, I spoke to him probably for 4 or 5 days myself, didn't tell anyone. We extended it out to maybe 4 to 5 people on the Friday to say, look, this is a go. But everyone had to go through the interview process. There was no shortcuts for anyone. And, you know, that's when he agreed, and the others did as well. And we had stringent criteria. As I said, we had Eddie. I come from a recruitment background myself, so it was going to be done in a certain way. So there was a lot of feeling out. A lot of trust had to be built up, and that was done. But the interview piece is kind of the last piece. You, if anything breaks down, it nearly breaks down in the period up to that, if you know what I mean. So it's a fascinating process, but if you do it right and you do it with a bit of structure, you'll get what you need in the end.
Yeah. So I guess it's been really interesting talking to you, Paul, because, like, we don't get often insight into what happens. And, you know, I'm delighted that you felt comfortable enough telling us these details, because I think it does give a full picture of exactly what you guys are doing in the background. And I also understand that you can't explain to everybody everything that you're doing along the way. So I don't know, is there, if, you know, in future, is there a way that if you were to go back 20 months when you did take the job first, would you change how you bring people along, or is that actually something that you couldn't do?
No, it's something you couldn't do. And again, this would have all been nipped in the bud if there wasn't a manager process going on. You see, I think what went on here, and I said, I'm moving on now. Everyone, Galway is going to move on together. We've had these calls. Like, Henry's an extremely unifying figure as well. Like, the stuff been worked on development, that's been worked on throughout the year, etc. Things blew up over the manager appointment. The manager appointment became political. So I wasn't going to come out in the middle of it and start a tit for tat or a back and over and jeopardize the manager process. We had a job to do. So, no, we keep the clubs updated. I think publicly, you know, in that maybe social media world or whatever it is, just to stop the abuse or the misunderstanding, we just have to get our message out better. But we will, but we'll do it when things are done, and I'm happy that it's in a place that it's going to thrive. You know, there's too many people out there telling us what they're going to do. I'm only interested in doing things, and that's the key piece.
The bit about, for example, the adult development squads and that kind of that, how the strength and conditioning and nutrition and coaching is all going to, those pillars are going to help with that and making sure that that player pathway exists. You know, you didn't come up with that in the back of a So that was obviously in gestation for a period of time. Is that the type of thing, maybe you are telling the clubs about this and it just, that doesn't filter out, and I don't know if that is a model that other counties are using or whatever, but wherever it's come from, it's a good idea. Is that the type of thing that in retrospect or in future you'll go, okay, these are the things we're doing, and then you get to challenge people, well, what are you going to do to help contribute?
Exactly that, and that's kind of where we're at on some of it, and this will be launched. I think we need to do something to say the clubs to get behind it, like you kind of touched on earlier on, how do you bring them along? This now will be launched, and maybe we have to just do that little bit more of a PR element and let it come out everywhere. But you're right, and then it's bring people with you. And on the adult, like, I'm not an expert in any of this stuff. I know as much about S&C as, you know, I don't, and nutrition, I don't, but I know it's important, and it's about putting those people in place. So I have a lot to do on the adult development squad side of, you know, we'll, that thing will probably only reach its potential over 2 years, I think. We'll set it up. It'll be a bit of a shaky structure. But we're already talking to people, you know, and the likes of the Michals to get their input in when we have all the managers in place about improving it and then bringing everyone with you. That's going to be the key, I think.
All right.
Yeah.
Paul, great stuff. Really, really fascinating. And congratulations on getting your man, because it has absolutely electrified the hurling world. And I think it has had this kind of bizarre crossover appeal where all of a sudden, in the depths of winter, we're like, ooh, what's going to happen in next year's Leinster Hurling Championship? Which,
yeah,
is not...
All we're missing is a game.
Exactly.
At the moment. Yeah, yeah. And listen, thanks a million, lads, for the time. As I said, it's just good to put the story out there, change the narrative. Hopefully it does, but that's what's going on in Galway. And hopefully now we won't have to talk about Galway again for another 3 or 4 years.
Well, we wish you the very best. If we don't talk to you for another 3 or 4 years, then you're, obviously things are going great. But hopefully we will check in at some point. Thanks a million.
Cheers, lads. Thanks very much.
It's Paul Bellew there. He's the Galway Hurling Committee Chairperson, who's obviously responsible for bringing Henry Shefflin in as the new Galway Hurling Manager. And I think that's plenty of good ideas there.
Yeah, he pulled up the bonnet and we had a look around. It's an interesting setup. It's like, I mean, I don't really envy anybody who's involved in these positions, and it sounded like it was one hell of a battle for this manager's job. And it was, I'm not sure, I haven't really heard too many chairmen coming out and actually saying this is how we do it, this is how it works. And how deep the process actually goes, and also, I guess the amount of funds involved and all that, because that certainly had been one of the questions that have been raised over the last little while, is the resources made available to Galway Hurling, whether or not it was enough. But clearly, he's making the point that there's definitely, without saying it explicitly, there's enough there to go win in All-Ireland.
Well, it's $700,000. That was the explicit figure that was mentioned. And it's because Colm Keyes, obviously, is, I think he might be the only person who does this. And it's an incredible bit of work that he does, where he pieces together the exact amount of expenditure that each of the counties has. I wonder, is there a central repository? Is there somebody in Croke Park doing that as well? Because that would be interesting for us to get a handle on. It kind of sets us off in a tangent conversation, but isn't the Dublin funding question coming up before Congress? Ray Kinnellan,
John Kinnellan,
so, yeah, raised the current player. Isn't he bringing that before Congress next
time? Yeah. That's going to normal Congress in February, isn't it?
So show me the brain space of the 320 delegates who are going to be like, I just need to think about this football structure, but I also need to think about funding for Dublin. It's like a...
There's a lot you got to be on top of to make an informed vote at Congress. I'll give the delegates that. But, I mean, the thing is, you can start preparing for Congress now if you're going to be a county board delegate rather than saying, oh, we didn't have enough time to debate this the week of.
Did we manage to make Congress and the selection of a manager sexy? Is that what we've done here in OTBM over the last...
There is nothing that is sexy about this show, Ger. Maybe we made it relatively interesting.
No. 8:30 this morning here on OTBAM, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We've got loads more coming up. Are we going to go straight to James Ryan? I think we are going to go straight to James Ryan. So Canterbury are the official kit partner to Irish Rugby, and they've revealed the new Ireland Rugby jerseys that will be worn by the men's and women's team throughout the 2021 and 2022 season. They're on sale now on elbries.ie and on Canterbury.com. Ireland played Japan, New Zealand and Argentina in next month's Autumn Internationals at the Aviva. Head coach Andy Farrell says the series is a building block towards the World Cup. He's already said that in 2 years' time. Lock James Ryan has told Will O'Callaghan that the squad are aware that the clock is ticking towards the tournament.
Well, it's probably in the back of your mind, you know what I mean? Like, that's the pinnacle, that's the world stage of our sport. So, you know, it is in the back of my mind. And you know, that's ultimately where we've got to go. You know, I think we've got five blocks together between now and then. But yeah, at the same time, like when the whistle blows against Japan or the All Blacks, I'm not going to be thinking that whoever selected, they're not going to be thinking about France in 2023, are they? So, but look, it is about, you know, in a sense, kind of, you know, trying to build towards that. And this block will give us an opportunity to, as I said, see where we're at and hopefully keep pushing on. I think we, you know, the England performance last year, the Japanese performance in the summer, there were some really good performances from us that, you know, that are probably the benchmark now. We don't want to go back. We want to use this block as an opportunity for us to keep pushing forward. So hopefully we can do that. And as I said, the challenge is now to get that off in the right manner against Japan in Saturday week. And the challenge of international rugby is... you know, that's the difference in terms of, you know, the time you get maybe with your province you don't get at times with Ireland. It's always very quick turnarounds, you know, in November, you know, the summer tour again, the guys that are selected, you know, the turnaround between the end of the domestic season and, you know, getting on a flight to New Zealand is pretty quick. Like, so I suppose mentally as well as physically, you've got to be pretty sharp.
Adding consistency is so important too. It's something Andy has spoken about continually. And I'm sure as players, you probably felt this too, where there's been a sprinkling of good performances in his reign so far, sometimes not so good performances. He's been keen to point out that it's been so stop-start because of COVID-19 and the pandemic, and, you know, training practices had to change, and that didn't help at the start of his first Six Nations campaign either. And then it was delayed and pushed back. But I'm sure as we kind of emerge from all this, adding that consistency of performance at international level as a squad is something you'll be very keen to do.
Yep, definitely, yeah. And I think we're starting to get touch wood that that consistency right. Like, look, as I was saying, that England game and obviously Japanese game, I think, you know, even though we had, you know, largely a new squad come in over the summer, you know, we were able to put in, you know, two, you know, decent performances. And look, we're obviously not going to look into the USA game too much, but I even thought the standard of what we delivered and, you know, what we talked about was pretty good. And yeah, I think it takes a while to understand, you know, how we're trying to play. And I think people are trying to get a real idea now of what we're trying to do. So yeah, that's the challenge this month. Can we put in three you know, top quality performances? We'd be happy with that.
Your own leadership within this group, it was about 12 months ago that Andy Farrell started speaking about how you were emerging as a leader. And I think I'm paraphrasing him slightly, but he said that you were kind of picking up things from the coaching team almost like a sponge and wanting to show that you were going to be a leader. You got to captain your country during the summer. I'm sure you would have preferred to have been in South Africa, but still you got to captain the international team. You got to captain Leinster at the start of this year too. Is this leadership side to your game something that you feel is really important about you as a player?
not particularly. I love helping guys and influencing guys, you know, particularly some of the younger guys now coming in. But ultimately, in terms of, you know, what I do, like, I just try to, you know, to put in a really good standard of training, and I endeavor to, you know, to perform well when I'm given the opportunity. And I think, you know, when you put in actions like that, your words probably mean a little bit after that. So, yeah, it's a kind of cliche, but I try my best to lead by example, I suppose. We've a good leadership group at the moment. You know, Johnny's back in, and, you know, you can see the difference he makes, you know, when he comes back into to training. I think we're in a good spot in terms of that. But, like, you know, the big thing for us is, you know, you want everybody to be leaders, you know what I mean? You want everybody to be leading by example and to be influencing. And that's kind of, you know, part of what we're trying to do this month.
Johnny Sexton, who comes back in after a very unusual time where he was actually able to get a break this summer. And, you know, the knock he had a couple of weeks notwithstanding, like, the games he's played for Leinster so far this year, you know, for a guy who's well into his 30s now at this stage, he has looked refreshed, he has looked hungry, and I'm sure he is determined to lay down a marker with his individual performances and helping the team out when these three games come around now.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think he's looked great. Whenever he's played, he's looked like he's had a real zip, a real edge about him. So it's a big block for him as well as everybody. And, you know, mentally he's as driven, he's as sharp as I've ever seen him. So I think we're in a good spot in terms of that. And, obviously, you know, Joey in with Harry in, and it'll be a good learning experience for them as well to be around him. He's looking good, I have to say.
Is the key for Harry Byrne now just to get a run of games without picking up a knock or an injury along the way? Because it's so clear the talent that he has, and he's been so unlucky. Like, I even think back to the Zebra game a few weeks ago, and he's sitting in the stand watching him. He picks up a knock and he has to go off after 20 minutes when he's getting a chance to impress along the way. It's really clear that he's got talent, but it's just a case of getting maybe, you know, some games into his legs now at this stage.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's like anybody, do you know what I mean? The more durable, the more robust you are, the better, you know, the more likely that you're going to get picked off the back of you know, I suppose, exposure. So I know he's working pretty hard, you know, in the gym to fix up kind of niggles and little deficiencies and things like that. So, you know, touch wood, he's able to get through this month, you know, training fully and hopefully getting a couple of opportunities as well.
I'm sure you're very pleased for your clubmate Dan Sheehan to be in here, also Kieran Frawley, in potentially to win their first caps this time around. You're rewarded for their provincial form, but for Dan particularly, you know, he's gone about his business very well over the last year and earned his place in the squad.
Absolutely, yeah. Anytime he plays, anytime he's come off the bench, really, he, you know, he's made a real impact. You know, for a hooker, he's a big guy, but, you know, yeah, I think he kind of has it all, doesn't he, really? Serious footballer, you know, in terms of his carry, his skills, defensively as well. He gets stuck in, you know, he's got intent about him. So this would be a great window for him. It's great to have, you know, such depth there at hooker net, you know, with Leinster, but obviously with Ireland as well. You know, Rob, Roe and Dan, three really good hookers, which is great for us as an Irish pack.
When it comes to depth, and I've asked all three of you this morning about this, because it's been so remarkable to see Keane Healy at his advancing years take on moving over to the tight head, which is a very difficult adjustment to make when you've been playing loose head for all of your professional career. Very impressive from Keane to move across. Also for Andrew now to get a chance to play a little bit more at loose head on the other side. And both provincially and for the country, this gives a lot more options in the front row a couple of years out now from a World Cup.
Yeah, no, it is. If there's any man that could do it, it's probably Church, you know what I mean? And it's particularly hard. I think I don't know enough about it, but well, I do know a little bit about it, but I know, you know, switching over from loose head to the tight side is a lot trickier than switching over from tight head to loose head. So as you said, being able to do that, you know, at that stage of his career is pretty impressive. And I think everyone would agree that anytime that he's, you know, he's come off the bench and he's been scrummaging on the tight head side, he's been very, very strong. We've won at least several penalties this season from him coming off the bench at the tight head side. So, look, it's testament to him and to the professional he is that he's, you know, willing at this stage of his career to say, yeah, look, I'll give that a go. I'll keep improving, keep growing. And yeah, it's great because we've got real, as I said earlier about the hooker position, I think in our front row across the board now, we've got real depth, which is really good. It's important for us. If you look at, you know, some of the top teams in the world now, just the depth they have in the front row is pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's James Ryan there in conversation with Will O'Callaghan at the launch of the new Ireland jerseys. You can get them in Elvries.ie from Canterbury. Now, John Duggan is with us. John, good morning to you. How are you?
Jared, Owen, how's it going on?
Very good. Speaking about the rugby, you were tweeting last night asking the question, hopping the ball, about whether or not people are willing to pay touts.
Well, $125 for New Zealand for the stand tickets. And
pretty expensive.
They are expensive. And will people pay more than that? And look, again, this legislation coming in that's going to outlaw this in this country. I always feel uneasy when I see All-Ireland tickets, for example, going on online websites. I really feel uneasy about that. But I don't think it's exactly a black and white issue as well. Like, I think if you're abroad, if you're let down by travel companies, say, in Liverpool, and you might need to pay over the odds. People have done it. Some people have felt guilty about it. Some people abhor it and think that people who pay tests are part of the problem. I think there's a big difference between selling and buying.
My concern is now that with the way the barcodes are done and the way that everybody you can have multiple versions of the same ticket, I would be terrified about buying something from a tout and going, and then it's like, diddle it. No, diddle it.
Yeah.
Hang on, why is the door not open? That would be my...
Yeah. I only bought a ticket from a tout once for face value now, because I think that he was giving it away effectively. It was Switzerland-Ukraine in the 2006 World Cup. Probably the worst game in the history of football. It went to penalties, if anybody remembers.
No.
It's funny, Emirates Airlines was on my ticket.
Right.
So that was interesting. But like sometimes, like I bet 20 avenues to get a World Cup final ticket in 2014 in Rio. I flew down there with a friend. Everything fell asunder. And we ended up with money in our pockets thinking, okay, we better might just have to do this. And then all the touts are getting arrested anyway by the military police. So we ended up with loads of money in our pockets and no ticket to the final.
So you couldn't get a ticket. That was, and you would have paid whatever at that stage.
Yeah,
to...
yeah. It was the late Johnny Lyons, myself, the broadcasting legend, if anybody knew him. We'd like $5,000 each in our pockets.
The two of you wandering around Rio. I said that was a good night, John.
It was. It's funny because you think about, you know where Slattery's is in comparison to the Aviva Stadium. Effectively watching the World Cup final in the pub outside the Maracanã. And it's funny because the Brazilians hate the Argentinians. And when Germany scored, the place was absolutely mental. And it was a good night, yeah. It was a bit of a mad week.
Would you have been willing to part with all 5K?
Yeah.
Wow, right.
Because it's, look.
Once in a lifetime.
And obviously, look, was lucky enough to get to one then a few years later, you know, thanks to OTB. But if Tottenham, the Tottenham thing in 2019, if I needed to pay over the odds and I'd had the cash, I probably would have done it. So maybe I'm part of the problem, but I think for very rare things, if you desperately want to go to something, and people are also making the argument as well on Twitter that, like, if Garth Brooks is playing in Dublin, and I know it's a much more legitimate thing, but our hotels ripping people off with inflated prices, there is a degree of market forces around this. I think there's a difference between you deciding in your personal situation to pay for something versus somebody nastily deciding to try to make a profit on an online site off selling it.
Yeah, and look, the thing is that with the hotels charging extra, yeah, they are price gouging. That's the surge pricing that we see with airline tickets as well. But you have the choice not to stay in that hotel. You could like pay a taxi to drive you 45 minutes out of town and stay somewhere else. There are options for you, but there are only a set number of seats available in the stadium, and that's why I think the protectionism was there. It's an interesting concept that the government believes that we can stop market forces. I mean, could we do this with, say, the housing market, maybe? Would that be where it would have a massive impact on people's lives?
Yeah, people paying over the odds for something. I mean, it seems that they've got a blueprint for how to actually tackle that thing. It would be nice if other things. But I mean, we're sports fans, so we can't complain, right?
I just want to tell everybody about this. Liverpool fans won't want to miss our latest Cadbury FC roadshow. We're going behind the scenes at Anfield with legendary striker Robbie Fowler. We'll also be joined by Liverpool captain and Ireland international Niamh Fahey and former Liverpool midfielder and physio Richie Partridge. It's all thanks to Cadbury FC and their club partnerships, granting you behind the scenes access at the Premier League's biggest clubs. Coming soon to OTB Sports social channels. What else, John?
Well, as the sports news from last night, Ronald Koeman obviously getting sacked. We know Barcelona's an absolute morass. It's funny, they almost should write a book on it. And I've got Simon Cooper's book at home. I've yet to read it. So I'm looking forward to reading that book to see how the whole thing unraveled. A bit of billion in debt and Messi's gone and Real Vallecano. Would they have been cited by Barcelona in the Guardiola era? Probably not, but they beat them 1-0 last night. We'd West Ham, who are almost the story of the season, really, at the moment in the Premier League, folks. Fourth in the table. Europa League group stage has gone great. Knocked out Man City on penalties in the Europa, the Carabao Cup last night.
And they're talking about extending the stadium.
To 62,500, I think it is. It'll probably be one more than Spurs. Because obviously they're very bitter red, didn't they, over Spurs were meant to go there in the first place.
We do have this sense that maybe David Moyes is in this job to get a better job, but there's a possibility that they're turning that club into something bigger and better, and that Moyes could stay there now and they could have stability in a way that they've never had stability. They've got the ground. Now, I was at a rugby match in that ground. It was horrific. The views were awful. It was for the Rugby World Cup.
It still doesn't have a great... I think it's improved, but I think it's got a bit better. I was speaking to somebody who was in London there a few weeks ago. I think it's got a bit better, but you're so far away from the pitch. I wouldn't think Dave Moyes would want to be going anywhere after being so scarred by Manchester United anyway. But Rice is the key. Like, when Rice goes, what happens? Because he's the complete fulcrum of the team. I know he didn't play last night, but look, they're very well organised, and you know exactly what you're going to get from West Ham. Liverpool obviously winning last night as well. Spurs did as well, and Brentford and Leicester. And we have a bit of golf going on in Bermuda. If you want to have a look, if you still have any faith left, otbsports.com and on the app. My selections are there for the Bermuda Championship for Virtual Insanity this week.
Are you feeling it?
I'm always feeling it. I was watching the Barney Curley documentary. Don't know if you saw it, lads. It was a really, really great piece of TV.
Yeah.
You know? And I had probably the perfect jump season this year in 2021. I had an amazing Cheltenham. Aintree, a 50-1 winner, Punchestown. But the golf has been a little bit in and out. I've hit about 20,000 crossbars. A little bit down, not too much down. But I don't feel in any way I'm a lesser tipster of golfers than horses. And just like as Barney Curley said, you just go through these streaks and you just have to wait and be patient and try not to get out of your hand with your staking. But I've gone for the... I watched this tournament last year boringly and pretty nerdily on a Sunday night in Bermuda. This is the real diehard stuff. So it's on again this week in Bermuda. Seamus Power and Gray McDowell are there. So I've gone for Lucas Herbert, who won the Irish Open and is a really talented young lad who plays well in the wind. I've gone for Lucas Herbert, Lee Hodges, Danny McCarthy, and Danny Willett is in there as well. I like him too. So we're just throwing a few darts at the dartboard and see if we can get a bit of profit back. But not losing the faith in it. And the Patrick Cantlay thing, which I did say earlier in the year, is coming to fruition and I think will come to bear in the majors next year. But look, it's an experiment. It's not really about the money. It's about the challenge of trying to get it more so than the actual winning, you know.
John, you're of an age where when you were growing up, Bermuda meant death.
Yeah, the Bermuda Triangle. Yeah, the planes. Because I don't know if you... Do you ever remember Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack?
No,
you don't. Okay.
Was it a TV show? Obviously.
It was a TV show. It was a really creepy, eerie, scary TV show about like murders in the States and that kind of thing. And it really took off in America in the late 80s, early 90s. They always had these segments about planes going missing in the Bermuda Triangle.
15 seasons of Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah, it's if you're into true crime, it was a pretty seminal series at the time. But they always had these kind of segments about really mysterious disappearances in the Bermuda Triangle. So
show me the proof that it's not a dangerous place to go, guys. I mean, Bermuda Triangle is not where you want to go still.
It seems to have stopped.
I've known nobody who's like gone to the Bermuda Triangle.
Have you ever heard of this? Was this a thing?
Oh yeah, 100%. This was like the corridors of my primary school. Kids used to whisper to each other and say, have you ever heard of the Bermuda Triangle?
Well, it's off North Carolina. It's much more north than I would have thought it was.
Right off Florida.
I thought it was North Carolina. I was thinking of... I'm always getting this mixed up with the Bahamas anyway. It's quite isolated. But the golf course looks nice. And look, I wouldn't mind being there now.
Quicksand on the Bermuda Triangle, that was how I was going to die. That was just when that was taken as a matter of course when you were a kid growing up, that one of these two things was going to do for you, and that was it.
And like, I mean, again, I've never heard of anybody walking to quicksand and come out alive. Same with the Bermuda Triangle. They are still, in the year 2021, notorious killers.
Well, no, because people go to Bermuda all the time.
I don't believe it. I don't believe it. My conspiracy is that that golf tournament that you're talking about, John, like, is happening in Bermuda. But the crucial thing about it is you can get to Bermuda from Europe and not have to fly over the triangle. My theory is that you just fly around the triangle, and that's what people are doing. And same with quicksand. It's just, you just don't step into it.
Excellent. What's coming up on the show on Saturday, John?
David Myler, great to have him back. So really looking forward to him. And a lot of clubs are playing at 3 o'clock, and at 5:30 United are going to Spurs. We're going to have a Saturday panel reviewing the week. So looking forward to the show with Johnny and Dan in the studio, David Myler, and a lot of talking points.
Good stuff, John. Thanks very much for that.
Cheers.
That's John Duggan giving us his thoughts on Virtual Insanity, as he says, available right now on the OTB Sports app. At 8:50 this morning, you're listening to OTB AM on, hopefully, the OTB Sports app, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. So, Gillette have partnered with Movember to encourage men to talk men's health and to support men as they shave down and embrace a mo. Movember is the leading men's charity, changing the face of men's health on a global scale, focusing on mental health and suicide prevention, prostate cancer and testicular cancer. To kick us into November, Tommy has been out for a shave down with All-Ireland final opponents Matty Ryan and Colm McShane. Gillette, proud sponsors of November. Gentlemen, it's your moment.
Let's talk about the comeback. Like, that was a long time coming, Carl. You had a tough time there for the guts of a year, probably more, was it?
It was definitely more. Obviously, there's a lot of it's a story in its own, really. There's so many things happen, and you know, trying to chat about it all and trying to get it all out there, you could spend days because so much happened. It was just like a roller coaster, to be honest. I think at the start, the thing for me was just learning and figuring out that it wasn't going to be too long. You know, it was going to be back pretty quick. So I was like, right, that's good news, or whatever. And you know, you're happy with that.
So what happened? Just remind us what
Yeah, just we're playing in Tuam in Galway, and obviously the pitch that day was a bit, you know, even in the warm up and stuff. I think Mickey Hart mentioned it in his book, the pitch as well, that the pitch wasn't in the best shape that day. And you know, I think as every other player would go, went for the ball as normal, and just the way it landed, you got a dislocated ankle and stuff. But instant reports were that it was all good and that it wouldn't be too, it wasn't, you know, it'd be back quick enough and stuff. So that was obviously positive to hear, but it ended up turning out that it was a lot worse than first feared. So I had a lot of regrets along the way too, because I feel that I kept a lot of emotions to myself, tried to like sort of think that this was going to be a quick fix, say nothing, nobody will know that I was ever away or that I'm going to be away, and I'll just be back playing football again. But I soon realised that wasn't the case, and that this was, I was in for a long run here with so many challenges ahead. And you know, I can safely say that I did have many, I know I spoke about this recently, saying just dark days and challenges that I had to face on a daily basis. And
how'd you get through that? Like, you hardly bottle up the emotion all the time, did you?
Well, that's it. I think at times where, you know, you're just, even, you know, you're going for your operation, things like that, and you're trying to just get in and get it done and say nothing and nobody will know, and, you know, again, you'll be back playing and stuff. But, like, as in, I just felt that I kept that to myself for a period, and then, you know, only obviously close people to me, like my family and friends, probably knew what was going on. And then any time I was out in the street, people were asking me what, you know, about the injury and stuff. And at the start, you know, you're trying to say, listen, it's hopefully going to be, you know, good, and you know, it won't be too long out and stuff. But it came to the stage then where that was just a bit annoying. I know people were just being, you know, very generous and trying to, you know, show that they care for me and stuff. But when things weren't going right for me, that became a bit of an issue then or whatever. But you know, days I was spending maybe 6-7 hours in the gym, you know, doing rehab, doing, you know, body sessions and stuff, just to try and keep myself in the best shape possible. And you know, when you're in the gym yourself, and it can be a lonely place over lockdown, because we were in furlough as well, so we were off work, and then we were in lockdown as well. So, you know, definitely sometimes it was lonely as well, but I had good people to reach out to, and, you know, at the end of it all, and they helped me massively going forward.
Yeah, I think we all kind of learned during lockdown in particular the importance of having a network and people you can reach out to and talk to. You must have had that around you?
I did. I definitely had good friends, good family, but again, GPA as well were a big help in this, and you know, just at the start, making sure that you know, I was aware of, you know, this could be a long journey and stuff, and any help that I needed was there and stuff. So that was all good to have, and just then, yeah, close friends, family, my girlfriend Caitlin as well was a big help. You know, the club owned Rosalie Patrick, they helped in any way, just wee simple things like, you know, maybe being stuck for a lift to, you know, get a scan or whatever, and people were like forthcoming, really looking to help, and that really put me at ease and helped me a lot. And it was always good to chat and you know, release things, and it made me feel better, because as I say at the start, I felt that I bottled everything up, even like an Instagram post, like I was like, should I post that, should I not, you know? And it's just like, you know, silly stuff, but they really, you know, really was you know, nipping at me and stuff. So I was glad that at the end up I got the help and just spoke out, and you know, it made things a lot better.
Matty, I know yourself, you would have had a couple of injury issues over the years, especially in and around 2018-19. You probably slowed down your breakthrough a little bit.
Yeah, no more than Cahill. Like it definitely is. It is tough when you're stuck kind of in the gym by yourself. You know, you're working away for your rehab, and it feels like you're going nowhere. But I suppose the one thing you kind of have to just keep telling yourself is that you're working. Like even though you're in the gym and you're putting on, you're using that time, I suppose, to build some muscle that you wouldn't have actually done while you were not injured and playing freely. So it's a chance for you to get stronger. So you kind of nearly have to reframe it and flip it into a positive.
Carl, so after you won, I was talking to Kieran McGeary that evening.
Yeah.
And I asked him about you coming off the bench. And he said, the big man delivers on the big day. So you did, like.
Well, that's it. You know, I did visualise making impacts, you know, doing good things. And let's be honest, like in 2019, my confidence was through the roof with what was going on in terms of how I was playing and, you know, what way the team was going and all the rest. Had some great experiences that year. Obviously, we played some big teams, and obviously we were pipped by Kerry in a game that, you know, if you were 4 points up in an Ireland semi-final half time, you're bound to be very, very happy with that. But second half didn't go our way. But yeah, definitely visualised making impacts, and you know, we often speak as a team about, you know, what we should do, and you know, things that maybe can work and all the rest. And that happens in training, it happens away from the actual, you know, playing surface and Croke Park and stuff. But you know, I've been involved in big games throughout the years, like on the 21 final, managed to pick up a goal that day and stuff. And it's just, I always put it down to these things are meant to be. And you know, like you have many down days as well, but you're always trying to stay positive and just visualize that success and visualize good things happening. And I just put it down to my hard work, because as yeah, Matty was saying, like whenever I was in the gym, you know, during lockdown, I was visualizing myself getting back stronger, fitter, better, stronger, because I knew that in 2019 I had learned so much in terms of my movement, in terms of getting stronger, faster. I knew that, you know, whenever I was back with Tyrone this year, I showed in training that I can still do it, and that I'm back at that level. So it was just a matter of probably preparing mentally for that impact role, because when I came on against Kerry, I had a good impact to the bench, nearly an impact that made, you know, cemented the sub appearance in the final. But I was
so
happy.
So you reckon you shot yourself in the foot by scoring 1-3 against Kerry?
Well, you can look at it that way, but I just know whenever I came back into training, I had performed well after the Kerry game, and I think then at the end of it just came down to, you know, we could do with that impact off the bench. And you know, I was more than happy to do that, because I'd come a long way the last year or two, and it was just all about helping the team. And I was never as glad to see that goal just rattle the net in the Ireland final.
I know I've spoken to Conor Myler about that pass and the move. It looked like a set piece move. Myler collects it, it's barely in his hand a split second, you've got the hand up pointing, and he just pops the perfect ball to you.
Yeah. Sometimes, like, you talk about these things and they never happen, but it was just funny, because at half time in the changing room, I just had spoke to a few of the lads, and I was like, listen, I've watched the first half there. I can see things that are happening. So I was like, get it in there, and we will get success. And it was funny. We were laughing about it after, you know, because it was just like a few seconds, and the boys were like, you know, you said that or whatever, and it came off or whatever. But again, other days you might try that and it doesn't come off. Do you know what I mean? So we're just delighted that the move came off. I know from looking, you know, my movement was probably at a bit of an angle to shoot out at a, you know, diagonally as well. So whenever Conor played the pass, I kind of had to, you know, just react to it as well. I knew I was getting closer to the goal, and it was just about finding a good connection, and thankfully I did that.
Absolutely. I think people can forget sometimes that you guys obviously put in an incredible amount of work to get to where you're at. You've both been on long journeys. Hasn't been a straight road all the way. there's a serious amount of pressure on you as well. Like, millions of people watch the All-Ireland Final. You know, when a normal year we'd have 86,000 people screaming and roaring you on both sides. There is pressure when it comes to playing inter-county football. You mentioned you're on the street and you have people coming up to you, and they mean well, but, you know, they're asking how you're getting on. So people are, you know, would approach you on the street and stuff. How do you find the balance between pressure and, like, it strikes me that Matty, going into the All-Ireland Final, yourself and Conor Loftus, there was a lot of talk about, I suppose, the impact that you'd have in such a positive sense, attacking-wise, for Mayo. So there was an expectation there, and there was an expectation on you, Cathal, after you scored the goal and the 3 points against Kerry in the All-Ireland semi-final. How do you manage that yourselves, that balance, that expectation? How is it for you?
Like, I suppose we just kind of, I suppose we try and keep it in within the four walls of the squad. Like, and like we just, like, we all, like every team, we have a game plan when we go out for every game, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And if it doesn't work, you go and you review the game, you see why it didn't work, and you learn from it, and you go again.
Have you watched back the All-Ireland Final?
I've watched it back. In terms of in-depth analysis, I just simply just haven't had the time between, like, work, you know, catching up with family, and we're in the midst of a championship season now with Brafe as well. So, to be honest, that's where all my focus has been the last while. But yeah, I'm sure once that all kind of settles down and we start looking forward to 2022, that's obviously going to be a focus for the first little while, and make sure we learn, watch back and learn from our mistakes. And yeah.
Do you thrive on pressure, or does it ever weigh you down?
I think from my point of view, like, you have to embrace it. Like, you really, you know, take it on and enjoy it, because, like, I like to think the type of player I am that, you know, if I made a couple of mistakes, it wouldn't faze me. You know, I just would go again and keep going. And that's right from whenever, you know, playing club football right into the Tyrone Seniors. I remember, like, even my first game against Mary's, where it was in the McKenna Cup, but a few mistakes, it didn't faze me. I still would keep going, and, you know, eventually you would get the reward. And I've played many is a game for Tyrone that, you know, hasn't gone my way, and, you know, it's just a matter of accepting that, really knowing to accept it and move on. And there's lots of different things that happen. Obviously, you know, I remember thinking, you know, I was always worried about how much I was clocking up in a game, you know, in terms of distance wise, and then it was always up in, you know, 10, 11, 12k when you're playing out the field, but then you made it 3 or 4 wides. Do you know what I mean? So I just, like, review all that and, you know, taper things to sort of try and make my performance better then. But in terms of you know, you could cover maybe 2k less, but come away with 1-4. Do you know that's sort of what I'm saying? But it was just really trying to get that high performance, and in terms of the pressure and the things, it was just really thriving on it and go and enjoy it.
Perfect. Well, I think I'm going to jump into the hot seat here, but I might get you to chat a bit about high performance and hitting those levels there, because I actually have a question for you. I'm going to throw at you before I get the razors to my face with Phil. All right, so the pressure's on me now. I'm getting the shave down and Phil, I don't know if you've much to work with here, but I'm looking forward to it, actually, because it's been annoying me leaving it on my face the last couple of days. Matty, Carl, I might let you chat away there for a minute. You're talking a bit about nightlife there, so I don't know if you want to stick with that or you want to get into something else, but...
Carl was just saying he was going to be in Coppers on Sunday night.
This again, it's opening up.
I haven't got the... No, listen, club football, so I think... What were you doing here in December, are we? So we'll have a night down in December, I think. All-star night, so we'll have to show our face then. Be.
Gillette have partnered with Movember to encourage men to talk men's mental health and to support each other as they shave down and grow a mow. Movember is the leading men's charity changing the face of men's health on a global scale, focusing on mental health and suicide prevention, prostate cancer and testicular cancer. Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, it's your moment. OTB
AM. 4 minutes past nine, time for us to turn our attention to the big story in world football. The Barcelona job is available at the moment, although there is a strong shout that there's one outstanding candidate that they are chasing. Graham Hunter is with us. Graham, good morning to you.
Hi, lads.
Xavi, is it a done deal? Is it close to being a done deal? Is there anybody else who might get this gig?
There was a list when Barcelona last thought about this. There's timing, isn't there? I've just got a message from Xavi. Gracias, crack, he says. so it's literally, honestly, I can show you that. A nice little one, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Look, there was a shortlist. There are other people that Joan Laporta has considered. But two, I think, really important things make this the most likely outcome. First of all, over the last 5 or 6 weeks, relationship between John Laporta and Xavi Hernandez. For anybody who hasn't followed Xavi, he's coaching Al Sadd to multiple trophies in Qatar. People can clearly have their own views about life and work in Qatar at the moment. And you can also say, well, Qatar and Al Sadd aren't Barcelona. Fine. But it's an apprenticeship. It's been successful. He's changed the club. He's changed the playing style. But during the last couple of years, particularly in the build-up to the elections that saw Joan Laporta made president of Barcelona again this spring, there was a slight chill in the relationship, which had previously been very, very good. And that's partly because before Laporta declared that he wanted to come back and be president of Barcelona, Xavi had said that he supported another candidate, Victor Font. This was before Laporta was in the race. So the fact that Laporta has had his nose a little bit of joint about that seems to me to be petulant. And therefore, it has it cut down the possibility of appointing Xavi last May when he should have been appointed. And it was crystal clear he should have been appointed. And when Joan Laporta made it public, this is not a leaked story, he made it public that before confirming Ronald Koeman for this season, he'd have a good look around to see if there was anybody better. Which is, you know, way to manage a club, way to motivate a coach, but also you cannot allow players to think this coach has his jacket on a shaky nail. You can't do that. So the relationship in the last 4 or 5 weeks between Xavi and Laporta has become much more fluid, much more chatty. And while Xavi hasn't been campaigning for Koeman's job and would have preferred to see the season out, there are two particularly privileged journalists who have been making it clear that Xavi would come immediately, would take the job now. So those two factors, the change in the relationship and Xavi's willingness to come right now, means that he's by far the outstanding candidate. And only if something goes badly wrong is he not in charge soon. And possibly, this is speculative, I don't have this, it's not just that I don't have this inside information doesn't exist yet. There is a feasibility that he could take charge for the absolutely crucial game away against Dinamo in Kiev next midweek.
That'll be quick, and that's what they need to do, isn't it? They need to get somebody in. If they're going to do Xavi, there's no point in messing around about like minor negotiations. If he's the guy, he's the guy. No, get him in.
Correct. And look, you asked me, so I'll give you my opinion. There is another candidate who I think is outstanding, and that's Luis Enrique. Luis Enrique coached successfully at Football Club Barcelona, got a little bit burned out because of the relationship with Messi, took him to the treble, was a successful manager, but is brilliant at playing, as you can see with the Spain side, brilliant at playing the style of football which made Barcelona over the last 20 years so much more successful than they'd ever been before. So much more loved, I think, outside their own city than they'd ever been before. Luis Enrique is still practicing that. He's one of the few in Spain who still is. He's working for the national team. He lives nearby, and the club is in his affections. I don't think he would leave the Spain job. I think he'd probably be wise at this stage not to leave the Spain job. But the reason you immediately said that would be quick with Xavi, there's no guarantees that automatically the thing that should happen in football will happen. And I've written an article for ESPN this morning with the little refrain, Mestion Club. It's a club in a mess. So whether it automatically is seen through properly, whether the financial difficulties that Barcelona are in hamstring them from being able to make the right move quickly, that's to be hammered out over the next few days. But they have a lifeline. They have a small possibility of qualifying for the Champions League group. They would have to win in Kiev. They would have to win at home to Benfica. They might even have to go to Munich and take something. Now, on last night's evidence, losing to the least resourced team in La Liga at the moment, Rayo Vallecano, losing in Vallecas for the first time in 2 decades, losing and running around like headless chickens, those types of things mean that it's a very slender lifeline in the Champions League. But the prospect of losing 40, 50, 60, 70 million euros by going out in the group is intolerable for a club that's in nearly 1.5 billion debt.
Could you put a little bit more meat in the bones, Graham, of Xavi and what you've seen from his apprenticeship at Al Sadd? Obviously, the results speak for themselves, but have you heard anything? Have you seen anything that suggests that Xavi will be able to handle that immediate pressure of needing to have some sort of European success in the short term?
I've been over there to watch him, to interview him, to go to his coaching ground. what you see is a guy coaching a team in a league whereby the various royal family sheiks divvy out. It's kind of like, and I know you're a fan of the draft, it's kind of like the team that needs a player should get a player. And therefore, if I've seen the situations with Sergio Garcia, who played for Espanyol and Zaragoza and won the European Championship with Spain in 2008. Xavi had him earmarked, and one of the ruling families said, no, he's going somewhere else. So to be able to be pretty dominant in a situation like that, to be able to guarantee that he brought across Santi Cazorla, who's been outstanding. On Xavi's word, and having watched Santi, Xavi reckons that Santi could still be playing for Real Madrid, for Barcelona, for Spain. He's been playing astonishingly. Aged, yes, but he's been playing as well as he's ever played. It's remarkable. But the football has had a really defined and clear principle. It's been similar to what would be expected of Barcelona and what similar to what Xavi played in. Similar, I stress. But the big thing is that in Al Sadd, he's learned to communicate. He's learned decision-making. He's learned coaching skills. He's learned the idea of being a manager and taking defeat and victory and talking to the media, all these kind of things. These are different roles to the things he excelled at. And he excelled at almost everything, in my opinion, during his playing career. The point you make about evidence of handling the stress, handling the attention, handling the big club mentality, I think he showed that as a footballer. I think he became, you know, a footballer, statesman at Football Club Barcelona. He is absolutely aware of what makes this, the environment around the Camp Nou tick, what makes the fans happy, what makes the media happy. The coaching side, I think he has the innate principles of how this squad still should be playing, still without question, the formation, the ideas. They have had players bought in order to, the quality level across the squad has gone down. Because you don't get a young Piqué, Puyol, Busquets, Alves, Messi, go on, Villa, Eto, Xavi and Iniesta. You don't get that. So the quality level has gone down. But the idea, the players have been bought to play the same way. So there's a fit between Xavi and the current squad. The difficult things for him, and I think most difficult, is that we don't have time, clearly, to properly put meat in the bones of how bad the Barcelona situation is in terms of not just the money, but the panic, how they're living day to day. Joan Laporta has less good counsel around him than he had when he was a massively successful president from 2003 to 2010. So Xavi's going into an extraordinarily difficult situation. It's my personal view that you will see immediately order and rigidity and confidence. Whether that's enough to do all the things that are needed short term, he'll need players back from the injury list. But I think it's the right decision. I think he's the right man short, medium and long term. Football's quixotic. So we'll see. You might be coming back to me in 8 or 18 months' time and saying, well, this isn't going well, Graham. Fair enough. Can happen in football. But I think that if they make this decision happen, it will be one of their best choices in many, many, many months.
Will he bring in a backroom team? Is there a getting the band back together? Is there an older, more experienced coach who'll be the conciliary, he's the public face in some ways of, and actually doing the, making sure that the pace of the rondo is fast enough at training, making sure that everybody knows exactly where they're supposed to be?
That's a question to which I have to say I don't know, because the manacles that are on Football Club Barcelona, I don't yet know if people like Alfred Schroeder and Henrik Larsson, and the club hasn't made this position clear, are out with Koeman. You'd suspect so, because they're both directly Koeman appointments. There's a man who was recently coach at under 21 level, I think with Denmark, who's a Catalan, who'd been brought back to the development side of the academy. He's going to be given charge, I think, of the squad this weekend in the league match. Whether he stays or not, I can't tell you. Finance will be the biggest answer to your question. How many people can Barcelona afford to contract? There will be a clear debate with financial fair play within La Liga about how easily Football Club Barcelona can pay Koeman off. He may have to wait for the remainder of his contract and hire Xavi. And these criteria, I know it's unusual when you talk about a big club on off the ball, and you wonder about who'll be brought in, who'll be moved out. Money isn't usually an object. It is now. It genuinely is now. I'll be a little bit surprised if Xavi doesn't include his brother, who's been part of the staff at Al Sadd. I think having his brother who he trusts and who's talented around him will be key. In due course, not now, but in due course, Xavi has made it absolutely clear that what he wants as his assistant is Busquets. Busquets is still playing at an extremely high level, still feels competitive, won't want to be player assistant coach. But Busquets will become somebody both on the pitch and off the pitch upon whom Xavi relies extremely heavily.
Right. Look, the parallels, the sacking last night led people to go, oh, Man United aren't going to do this. It's, you know, the parallels with Solskjaer. There is a fear that Xavi might not be a world-class coach because we don't know. And that's the bit where that's the leap into the unknown for everybody here.
Where genuinely is it not? If you're hiring an elite coach with a proven record, but you're a new club with a new culture, you don't know that it's definitely going to work. You can reduce the risk, clearly. If you say, you're a club, I don't know. In your mind, name any club you think of, and you're reaching out for Conte, for example. Who could I be thinking of? Because it worked at Chelsea, is it automatic that he'll work in the environment at Manchester United? Is that fear factor about, is he the right guy at the wrong time? Is he the right guy in the wrong situation? These things apply to even people with the most stellar track records. That's a fact. Now, go back to what I used in my ESPN column today. I know this, people don't talk about this very much, but one of the things Sir Alex Ferguson thinks he most benefited from throughout his career was his aggressive willingness to grasp a nettle. He saw a thorny issue coming, one which potentially would have far-reaching consequences, a decision he didn't particularly want to make, or a decision which carried with it a lot of pain for people around him who'd previously been important to, whatever it might be. And listen, the length of his career, we're talking about a vast range of these types of decisions. And he preached that around him, other chairmen, other managers, other players, even other agents, would sit on a decision, would be fearful, would take the elements that you just asked me and say, well, what if, and what if, and they would, you know, instead of getting off the pot, you know, they wouldn't defecate. And the truth is that decisions like this come around far more often in elite football clubs than we have time to broadcast about. And those who, it doesn't mean that a speedy decision is always right, but Ferguson's doctrine was that if you let a big decision, like whether you were hinting at Conte or whether you're talking about Xavi Hernandez, if you let that fester and you take time and others move on, weigh up the consequences, accept the consequences, and just get on with it, having done a proper mental preparation about what is the right thing to do, don't then go, God, what will be said? What might happen? Will this threaten me? Is it the right thing to do? Your research, make your decision, and throw everything behind it. If it was good enough for Ferguson, why wouldn't it be good enough for Laporta?
It would be a really interesting sort of, if you had a time machine, experiments to see how Pep Guardiola, coming from the B team, would get on in this situation, because that is what we always reach for, Graham, is like, who can be someone like Pep, somebody who you take a little bit of a gamble on and turns out to be a genius.
Look, I agree with you, but we mustn't make a comparison, irrespective of what we think about the two Catalans. Pep was taking over an extraordinary squad. He's never hidden that, nor have you on this show. He was taking over a frustrated and unfulfilled Thierry Henry, Yaya Toure, Xavi, Iniesta. He'd had a season coaching off and on Pedro and Busquets in the B team, having promoted them himself. Nobody but him knew that they were ready to come through. He had a frustrated and angry and still prime Puyol, Eto'o. If you were to hand that squad to Xavi Hernandez, there's a fair argument that he might do something similar to what Pep did, because it was extraordinary and it was bubbling under. It had a rotten season, standards had declined. And there's one thing that needs to be talked about, and it's a fact. For whatever reason, Ronald Koeman's intensity of training regime, not just how hard they run, but the timekeeping ethics, what's done on the training pitch, how much analysis is worked through, how much time, how much productive time players are expected to spend at the Joan Gamper Training Centre had fallen long, long ago behind any of the elite levels around Europe. And it's a part factor in why you saw them being thrashed by PSG, thrashed by Roma, thrashed by Liverpool, thrashed by Juventus at home, thrashed by Bayern Munich. These things, that you can't change overnight in terms of seeing the results, but you can change that climate overnight. I'm not saying Koeman was as bad as Rijkaard. He had really difficult private life problems and lost the plot over the last year and a half at Barcelona. Koeman was just set in his ways. This chunk of time is enough. They didn't properly play. They didn't game out defensive set ball, set play situations. So Koeman kind of left them to make it up as they went along about how they defended set plays. I mean, that's just not something that's incredulous in the modern era. That's, you know, 50 years out of date. It's a small example. But these things can change automatically. And therefore, I'd like to believe that I don't have to do the time machine comparison between Pep and Xavi very often. It possibly needs teasing out, because if you value my point of view, I'm able to say it's extraordinarily different. I'm exponentially worse situation that Xavi is taking over. That's what it is. How often does you ask both of you? How often does your perfect job come along?
Oh, never.
In perfect circumstances. Yeah. There you go.
Well, for Guardiola, it obviously was perfect. But it actually sounds like, in a weird way, you see the opportunity there for him to come in, whip things into shape quickly, and be a jolt of electricity through it. As opposed to, because for me, if you were the career advice, you'd be like, Let's just see how Laporta handles this debt issue, and in 2 years' time, then you can ride to the rescue if the money's still there. But if it all goes tits up, Xavi, you don't want to be the one who's like,
you might counsel somebody else that way. That's not what you would do. And if you tell me otherwise, you're lying. If that equivalent opportunity came for you, you would take it.
Yeah, fair enough.
And men are women of, and not because it's Barcelona or there's a big salary. Men and women of talent back themselves. You can sit around and paddle about and think, oh, I'll go daisy picking for a couple of years to see if the debt situation gets. No, ridiculous. If you believe in your talent, if you've been used to a life of sacrifice, which brings you glory, brings you satisfaction, when you're football hungry, football addicted, as Xavi is, none of these things guarantee success. Clearly they don't. This is the reason I enjoy being on here is it's just, you've got such an educated audience. So clearly there is no magic wand. It's Xavi, it's Barcelona, therefore push, push, push. But no way would you turn it down unless you're working for a president who you knew was hair trigger and who might damage you, and somebody over whom you had no influence whatsoever, no trust. Maybe then you might think, however good I am, that's a poison chalice.
Yeah.
The poison chalice about the lack of success, the diminution of quality in the squad, the debt situation, those things you go like, I can make a material difference there. And I don't know if we're closing, but think about who's going to be important to Barcelona immediately. Gavi, Pedri, Nico, Balde, Ansu, Araujo. The youngest, 17, the oldest there, I think, 22. Xavi's ability to take those players and say, I've been where you are, follow my lead, do this, change that. Your body shape, your position, your timing, your pass, all of that fits like a glove. Now, if you get that small bit right and you get the leading lieutenants who've been quite good overall this season, if you think about Alba and Piqué and Busquets, you get them fixed and you coach the youngsters and there's a momentum behind you, decent things can be achieved in a short space of time while you set about the process of rebuilding and restructuring, which is a longer term thing.
Graham, great stuff. Thanks a million. Take care. Graham Hunter there giving us his thoughts on Ronald Koeman and the era is over. Seems pretty clear Xavi's the man.
Yeah, I think so. And it's like, as he says, there is a couple of big gains to be made immediately, which will turn things in the right direction in the short term. So I think no matter who you get in at this point, it probably seems that way. I'd say there's a bit of a malaise that's after setting in with Koeman.
Koeman was never that good a manager. Really? No, you never would have said that he deserved it. It was the same. There's no other club at that level that thinks, oh, I need to have Ronald Koeman manage us.
No, and like even there was something surprising about the success with the Netherlands to a point.
Yeah, it was shocking.
Like it like
turns out he had some really, really good players.
And maybe that team is like exceptional in comparison to other international teams. That Netherlands team that he had relative success with in the qualifications for the Euros, for example.
And it wasn't a tournament. You know, we haven't seen him sustain that even for a significant period of time. So, OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. If you're a Munster fan looking for something to keep you going while you count down to your next trip to Thomond Park, there's a brand new Munster Rugby podcast over on the Rugby Channel, The Red 78, with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Every Wednesday, they bring you in-depth analysis of each weekend's games, interviews with some of the biggest players, and all the action from the other teams around the province. Here's a taste of this week's show following Munster's loss to Ospreys.
Was it an attitude? Because I was kind of thinking to myself, maybe the attitude is not right. Maybe the players just dropped the standard in their minds a little bit and thought that it would happen and sensed that they just needed to turn up. Because, look, the players can give out and say that that's not the case. And I know no player would have went over there thinking, oh, we're just going to turn up here. But if you're a couple of percent off it and you know it as a player yourself, and then the mistake started to happen and it just got away from him.
I think you just hit the nail on the head there in relation to, so obviously listening to Toby Booth before it, and they kind of had this kind of backs against the wall mentality, like chip on the shoulder type of a thing. And also the fact that if you are a couple of percent off at this level, no matter who you're playing, you can't really afford that at this level, especially this year with this new kind of URC. I think the standard has gone up across the board. I just think sometimes it's very difficult to try and get to them to that mental pitch, you know, 5 weeks in a row. It's incredibly difficult, irrelevant of whether you're in and out of the team or, you know, you haven't played for the whole 5 weeks. The freshness of the group, I think that's something that maybe that they might look at going forward, because at this level, like, everybody's a really good rugby player and everybody can do all the basics really, really well. What sets you apart in teams? And when you look at the likes of, you know, a Leinster's or a Connacht's and stuff like that can play this free-flowing rugby, what sets them apart from a Munster team? Well, it's their ability to get to that emotional pitch and be able to balance it really well. I just think that sometimes you need that underdog type of thing. Does a favourites title sit well with them? They were definitely favourites to win that. And like your era, don't take it the wrong way, but you were brilliant with the chip on the shoulder tag and the underdog tag. And I think that, you know, probably sometimes Munster need that. Maybe they needed that chip on their shoulder going into battle.
It's Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs there talking on the latest episode of the available every week wherever you get your podcast, Red 78, on the Rugby Channel, and you can get it at Rugby Channel 15 as well on that one. Here's what's done sports radio today between now and 7 o'clock. OTB Gold at 1 o'clock is Cora Staunton. The Snap is live from 2. Leaders Questions with Stuart Lancaster from 3. The Retro Panel from 4 is GAA Democracy. Interested in hearing what that's about. OTB Gold is Brian O'Driscoll meeting Ethan Asseaway just a week after he kicked the winner in the European Cup final in Bilbao. And then the show is live tonight from 7 o'clock as well. Right, I want to tell you a little bit about this. Netflix new series, Colin in Black and White, goes live tomorrow, October 29th. Colin Kaepernick narrates this drama series, recounting his formative years navigating race, class and culture while aspiring for greatness. Our own Ronan Mullen was speaking to Oscar-nominated filmmaker Ava DuVernay, as well as stars Jaden Michael and Mary Louise Parker. Have a look.
Let me share a story with you that's not told enough. While I was in high school, I still had a lot to learn about the way the world works. But you know what? I wouldn't trade those moments for anything.
Hi, Ava. Congrats on the new project. I just want to start with, in your initial publicity around this project, you described Colin Kaepernick as a singular American icon. For someone in your position who's so well-versed in figures of social and societal change, what would you say is the uniqueness of Colin in that regard that sets him apart as singular?
Wow, what a great question. Right off the bat. Come on, Ronan. I think that he is with his defiance of the NFL, which is such a longstanding institution in the United States, defiance within that particular institution that's so vocal, that's so demonstrative, that's so permanent, something that he wasn't willing to let go of, even in the face of great, great challenge, of great sacrifice to his own career, of political and presidential pressure, that he always stood solid and centered in his convictions. I think that's a remarkable thing to do. And it is certainly in this moment in time, a singular action that defined him, but also defined an era. And so to be able to delve into this with him was really an honor.
Since the day I was born, my passion, my love, was being a quarterback. But what you start out as is not necessarily what you become.
And from your initial interactions with Colin, in terms of the maybe shared goals that you and him settled on in terms of what you wanted to achieve from this show, like what were those goals and how did you set about achieving them?
Yeah, he was really interested in using his early life to kind of talk, to level set and to lay a foundation for people to understand who he is and why he's committed to the things he's committed to, right? For me, I was interested in using who he is to provide a springboard and talk about larger cultural, societal issues, historical issues that are of great import. And so we both had kind of two different goals going in. And I think the collaboration was so lovely because we were able to find a way to make something that feels different to me, fresh in some of the ways that we did it, but that allowed us both to do what we wanted, him to speak about his life and to create a foundation for people knowing him and have more context for his actions, and me to use his life to talk about things that affect all of us. And so it was a good partnership.
Growing up with white parents, I assume their privilege was mine.
You two good?
Okay.
Fine, thanks.
Yeah, I'm good too. Thanks.
I was in for a rude awakening.
We going ultra black.
What's up with Kaepernick? The hair. Something climbing out the back of his head. Not acceptable.
Pitch black like the night. We going ultra black.
It's November, and you have no offers for football. You want to be somebody's second choice?
I'm ultra black.
You're just going to have to prove them wrong.
Why am I always the one that has to prove them wrong?
Nobody fault. I tell the truth. I know it's facts.
Sometimes I just feel uncomfortable.
Chin up, Colin.
I couldn't rebel because I didn't know how. But now...
You mentioned the freshness there and sort of the unique way you set about achieving it in this show. And from a directorial point of view, it's obviously very interesting that you mesh the maybe the levity of some of the scenes with the, obviously the gravity of the underlying themes, and also mechanically with Colin himself being in the show itself. But that must have been an exciting challenge for you to maybe have all those plates spinning in the air.
It was. It was a beautiful experiment for me as a filmmaker, working with so many different forms. At some point, there's Doc. Then you have him. He's in the gallery of like his mind. Then he's seeing memories. Then there's moments in the gallery where like other actors and memories come to life as a play inside of it. And then you've got Jaden Michael, who's playing him on a set in Los Angeles. So directing all of that was incredible and challenging and fun. But, you know, as a filmmaker, you try to find the things that can push you a little further. And so I learned a lot from this. It was a tough one, but completely refreshing. And so I hope people kind of take to it. It's an experiment in a bunch of different styles. But I really, I had a ball.
I got a toast to that. We don't fold and crack.
Like as someone in their late teens now, you're not so far removed from the period of Colin Kaepernick's life that you're depicting in this series. I was just wondering, were there many parallels or crossovers in terms of your maybe time at school or upbringing and what you're showing for Colin in this program?
Yeah, I think Colin and I started to notice our differences amongst society at a similar time. I think maybe I was 13 or 12, maybe a little bit earlier, only because I was, you know, a part of the entertainment industry and
you know, I guess I was pushed out a little earlier, but I definitely felt similar sentiments of, you know, why is he there and why am I still here? You know, why is someone, you know, going forward and I seem to be in the same spot? And a lot of that gets, you know, in your head as someone who's growing up, you start contributing it to, oh, maybe it's because I'm not capable enough. But I think as I grew up, I started realizing that there's so many other variables and that you can't blame yourself for everything. And a lot of it is the politics and the society and the expectations in our and rank and class in our world. And I think in a similar way, Colin started to realize that. And Colin realized that, you know, I can stand up for myself. I can use my voice. And I don't need to be shackled to the society's expectations.
And obviously an acting prodigy yourself, but Colin, one of Colin's main things as a youngster was multifaceted athlete and basketball, baseball, football. What was the preparation like for that? Trying to get ready to present one of these generational athletes on screen, and did Colin have many hands-on conversations with you in terms of tips and that kind of thing?
Yeah, so I had never played team sports before, and I kind of had to spend 3 months learning 18 months of three different sports because Colin was an all-star athlete. But it was really great having a bunch of coaches around you trying to help you, trying to teach you, and it helped me prepare for the role differently because now I'm thinking about Colin as you know, and incorporating these sports ideas and, you know, being the leader, you know, as a quarterback or as a pitcher. And that definitely contributed to my overall performance and how I thought about Colin. But Colin was a part of the physical training aspect. You know, the trainers would take videos of my performance physically, and then they'd send it over to him, and he would sort of analyze it and return with notes. So it was sort of scary because you know that there was a professional athlete telling you or giving notes. But I think it was all great because then I knew that I was actually doing it right. You know, a professional was telling me I was doing it right. Black is
beautiful. Love your blackness. You will know who you are. We going ultra black. I got a
toast to that. We don't fold the crack. As an adoptive parent, of course, in your own life, were there strands of your own experiences you were able to draw upon, or how did you set about defining your approach to this character?
Yeah. Well, as a parent of an adopted child and a parent of a biological child, you are just always doing your best. And sometimes you're off, you know, sometimes you're doing everything that you can with all the right intentions and you still like fail is a strong word, but you still might miss the mark and not give them what they actually need. But it's not for the lack of trying, which is what I wanted to be able to show with this character, because I have, you know, as a mother, I have compassion for that. I understand that. And I think we draw from what we learn, you know, from the people that we admire. And I was lucky enough to have that. And Colin's mother, you know, she, I feel like, was doing what she could with her set of circumstances and where she came from. And it's a really charged issue, especially when it comes down to hair. And I think it's something that white people should all watch that episode just to understand. And it could be 8 episodes just on hair. It's a very charged, very kind of bottomless subject, and it represents a lot to a lot of people. I loved that they tackled that they kind of took that as a whole episode, because it's a topic that white people just don't even consider. You don't even think about what goes into black hair. I mean, I could ask you 3 questions and you probably fail all of them. And P.S., I would have failed them too if I didn't have a black child, you know? And it's humbling. Mm. It's really humbling.
And obviously your partner in this whole process, Nick Offerman, who'd probably be more known as a TV dad, Mary Louise. But what was it like to work with Nick? Probably something you were keen to do from a long way out.
He's awesome. And, you know, of course, my son was so excited that I was working with him. And he's incredibly charming and just as warm. He's what you'd think he would be. He's warm and funny and sweet and he has a great deal of humility, which is that's always refreshing in an actor, you know.
And just lastly for me, like, the way the show is put together is quite nuanced and unique. Obviously the some comedic elements, but also the grave and the gravity of the themes being discussed. And yeah. Also most particularly probably Colin Kaepernick's own presence in it as a narrator, or not just a narrator, but almost a presenter, because narration's not that uncommon with Everybody Hates Chris in these types of shows. But just from someone who's so experienced in TV as yourself, to what extent do you think Colin's actual visual presence in the show enhances the whole product?
I think enormously. I think it's immeasurable. Because to see, you can almost sense what it cost him, you know. It's a pretty vulnerable spot to put yourself in. And he's, you know, just by the gesture alone, the kneeling, you see that this is a man who is nothing if not brave, you know. He in a way epitomizes everything our country was supposed to be and is striving to be and could be. We going ultra black.
OTB AM
with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.